man.
Come on. Let's go exploring. What are you looking at? Come on. What are you looking at? Come on. You're not supposed to put up her pictures.
Sneaking around spying on me, boy? How many of those have you had?
I'm Jennifer.
You're who?
Jennifer.
What happened to Mary?
I told that intern that I fell down some stairs. I didn't tell him that my 12-year-old, who had just murdered her father, was trying to murder me.
Hi, this is Larry Zerner from Friday the 13th, Part 3, and you're listening to The Hysteria Continues.
And indeed you are. Welcome back to The Hysteria Continues. This is episode 139. And this time we have a very, very, very special guest with us. We trailered it last episode. We're joined by Amanda Reyes, a.k.a. Amanda by Night, who's going to be talking to us about small-screen slashers and also her new book, Are You in the House Alone? So, Amanda, very excited to have you with us. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, considering it's 5 a.m. and I have a cold.
Well, yes. That's good. So, have you got over your hangover from meeting Eric, when Eric was plying you with drinks in London?
I know. I'm still drying out from that.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
That much drink.
It was a lot. It was a lot. We started like at 5 p.m. and drank till like midnight at least.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a rare occurrence for me, obviously. So, fantastic to have you with us, Amanda. And obviously, in your honour, we're going to be doing is not really a small screen slasher, but it has slasher movie leanings, and I think enough for us to talk about, and also has some special resonance with me, and I imagine with you, Amanda, which is Don't Go to Sleep, the TV horror ghost slasher kind of hodgepodge to make it sound bad, but no, like a mega mix is a better way of putting it, from 1982. So
ghost question mark.
Oh yes. Ooh. Yes, well, it's controversial, so we will be coming onto that later, and talking to Amanda more about a book, and also we can have an in-depth chat about TV movie slashers and whether or not the slasher movie ever made a kind of decent kind of foyer into the small screen, and I'm sure we'll have some lots to talk about with that. So looking forward to speaking about that shortly. But before I do, Eric, how are you doing?
Well, considering I'm nobody's favourite anymore, I'm doing okay, I suppose, but I'm finding it kind of tough.
Oh, are you? Okay.
Yeah. Joseph's my favourite, by the way.
Ah, okay. Well, how are you doing, Joseph?
Hi, this is Joey Sleaze reminding you not to go to sleep. Don't go to sleep, because I'm the dream warrior.
Ah, see, you've been thinking about that one. That is very good. So thank you, Joseph. And Nathan, as the current favourite, although we may have a straw poll with Amanda by the end of the episode to see who her current favourite is. I imagine it might change.
But well, I should clarify that Justin's the one I want to have sex with.
Yeah,
that makes it even worse. That pushes me even further down the rankings.
You're the one I want to watch 90210 with.
Okay.
See, but I feel so bad because when we recorded in London, I messed up my joke, and that's supposed to be, I told Justin I was in love with him, and he told me I needed a spotted dick. I forgot to say that.
Yeah, you had to be there. We were talking about British puddings. So, Nathan, as Amanda's current favourite, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing great as her current and future favourite.
Well, yeah, I specify the current because it could change, Nathan.
It couldn't change. There's no way. Amanda,
I'm going to be Amanda's favorite.
Our word is our bond.
I'm going to be her favorite, and I'm not going to stop until that happens.
Well, jumping forward to Don't Go to Sleep, just very briefly, there's Jennifer and Mary in there, but both have a touch of Inger about them, don't they? So I was wondering if Eric was more Jennifer, but I see you more of as a Mary. Eric, what do you think?
I'm not a Mary.
You're a little bit of a Mary, aren't you?
No.
Well, we don't really see Mary's true colours, or we don't really see her Ingerisms really until the end. But well, let's let's wait. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But what we've been watching recently, and Amanda, as our special guest, before we get into TV slasher, the small screen slasher territory, what have you been watching in the last few weeks? Anything of note?
Yeah, well, I went to Texas Frightmare last weekend, and I met Dario Argento, which was like the most amazing thing that ever happened in my entire life.
Wow.
And
which one is he?
He's this little-known filmmaker that's from Italy. Very few people have heard of him, and he made this movie called Suspiria, and they were having a 40th year anniversary for it. I can't believe it's been 40 years. So, you know, all the vendors were there, like all the vendors that you guys know already because you've already done their commentaries, but like Vinegar Syndrome and Arrow and Severin. And so every year that's when all the DVD buying kind of happens in my life. So I picked up a bunch of movies. I grabbed The Initiation, which you guys did the commentary for, but I only got a chance to rewatch the film, not listen to the commentary. I hadn't seen it in forever. I really, really love that movie. I think it's super charming. I love Daphne Zuniga. She's so adorable. And there's this really great scene. So the movie is, I know you guys covered it, but just to go back real quick, it's sort of about this girl having dreams about this guy getting set on fire at the beginning. And so there's a lot of Freudianisms in there, and there's a lot of sexual repression and just general repression and repressed memories. And there's this really great scene. I have a still from it somewhere on my Facebook page with the guy who plays the a doctoral student who's helping her with her dreams, played by James Reed, and he's standing in front of a chalkboard, and the word analog is behind him, but he's covered up the OG, so it just says anal. And it's, like, exposed over by his left shoulder, and it seems so, like, meant to be there, like that's not a mistake.
Yeah.
And that's, like, my favorite scene in the movie, but it's a really, really fun movie, and so I watched that, and then I watched Sometimes Aunt Martha Does Dreadful Things, which is a first viewing for me. And I don't know if Nate's seen it, but it reminded me of Criminally Insane and a little bit of The Love Butcher in terms of its aesthetics and sort of the directorial style. I don't know if anybody here has really seen it, but it's about these two guys who are sort of on the run, and one of them is dressing up as Aunt Martha, and they're living in this house, and all these people keep coming by, and the younger guy, he's like a drug addict, and he can't like stay in the house, and he can't like hide his appearance. So he keeps going to like these places and getting high and picking up chicks, but he's gay. And so whenever he gets too close to a woman, he kind of has a freak out. And the other guy, who is Martha, is his partner. And so there's all this weird jealousy. Like, it's probably marginally offensive to watch now, but it's also like a pretty good, solid little weird film. And I really like that. And then the third thing and last thing I saw was something called Double Exposure, which is sort of what they marketed as an American giallo. I don't know that I would have connected the two if somebody hadn't said that to me, but it stars Mike Callan. It's got all these TV people in it. It's got Mike Callan. All of them were on Fantasy Island at some point. Joanna Pettit. James Stacy, who's probably unfortunately most famous for losing his arm and his leg in an accident. And then he was on his way to being really famous, and then he kind of, you know, dropped out and did a few films here and there. And it's got Victoria Jackson, and it's about this guy who's this photographer, and he's having these really wicked dreams, and he's killing people in his dreams, and he's starting to think that the dreams are real. And whenever he gets too close to a woman, he gets these kind of psychotic tendencies, and he meets Joanna Pettit, who's this beautiful blonde nursing home employee, and he keeps trying to, like, not have sex with her, basically, and all this stuff is happening around it. And it was surprisingly effective in terms of the relationship. So James Stacy plays the brother, and they look exactly alike. First of all, I thought Mike Callan was James Stacy, and I wondered how they got the prosthetic arm on there because it seemed to move so well. And then I realized they were two different actors. And their relationship is really well done. And also the relationship between Mike Callan and Joanna Pettit and their dating life is really, really well done. And so it's this weird kind of, I don't want to say it's sleazy because I don't think it's that sleazy. I think it's pretty slick. But it's also got these really strange intimate moments in it that work so well that made me kind of fall in love with the film, including a really interesting sex scene between Joanna Pettit and Mike Callan. And I only bring it up because of how weird it is in the film, because he doesn't want to have sex with her because he's afraid he's going to hurt her. And so they're rolling around in the bed for like 5 minutes in this montage where they keep cutting back and forth to like him trying not to have sex with her. And it's like this really weird kind of naturalistic scene in the middle of like him putting garbage bags over women's heads with snakes inside them. You know what I mean? And so it's this really weird slasher thing that I found to be really effective. And I read Justin's review of it. I think I feel kind of on the same page with him, except I liked it more. And we also saw a screening of The Slayer, a 4K restoration of it. That was really good.
Cool. Okay, well, that sounds amazing. Time sort of meeting Dario Argento would have been fantastic. So did he speak any English, or was he?
He did. So I wanted to sit on his lap, but it seemed inappropriate. So I've tried to sit on William Ragsdale's lap too. I think he was more into that than Dario was. But his English isn't great, but it's pretty good. He understood what I was saying. He let me put my head on his shoulder. He seemed really into it. He was like really sweet, but like the line was so long that it was like, you know, it was no way you could spend much time with him. So I had to cram in a lot of like, oh my God, I think you're so amazing. I love you. Your brain is beautiful. I love you. Like in 2.5 minutes, and I did it. And he was really pleasant about it. He put his hand on my cheek and he smiled. So I think he understood me. Or maybe he saw that come hither look in my eyes, and it's just the universal language of love spoke to him. I'm not sure yet.
I'm sure it did, Amanda. I'm sure it did. So. Well, then that's fantastic. Well, yeah, very exciting. I mean, we don't really get to. We'd love to go over to something like that, Eric, wouldn't we?
We would.
We don't really have anything about the only things we get to see is we kind of somebody who played the Dalek in Doctor Who. In 1975.
Yeah. Well, Rich, you did that weird conference with Ruggiero Deodato where it was like an academic conference,
oh,
right?
That's true, yeah. I did have...
amazing.
Well, I did get to spend an awkward half an hour with Ruggiero Deodato, sort of him not speaking any English and me not speaking any Italian, sat at a table with him not drinking and me sort of trying to make
stop
conversation.
Drinking, yeah.
Just stop drinking.
How do they dub movies if their English is not that great? Like, well, how do they know that the translation works? You know what I mean?
Well, I think given something like Troll 2, they don't know the translation. So,
yeah. Okay.
But sometimes I think he did speak a little bit of English, but it was an interesting thing. I was trying to talk to him about body count, and he didn't really remember much about it. But and also his English.
Mamma mia.
Yeah. But anyway, so no, well, thank you, Amanda, and
thank you.
And Joseph, how about you? What have you been watching recently?
Well, the only thing I watched was this guy apparently was inspired by The Night Before Easter, so he made a slasher film in a storage facility with a Santa Claus. I apologize for him being inspired by that movie. But either way, it's a short film. It was pretty entertaining. It's called Axmas. It's basically about a bunch of kids who go into a storage facility to party. They even have questionable-looking beer bottles, like we did, and they get picked off by a Santa Claus in like 25 minutes. It's a cheap, low, low, low budget, but I enjoyed it. It was kind of fun. It's kind of flattering that someone liked that movie enough to kind of, I guess, ape it in no short terms. Again, I don't know why you would want to do that, but more power to you.
Excellent. Well, that's we have to look out for that. And how's the preparation going for From Dusk Till Dusk We Part? Is it?
Well, George Clooney backed out.
What is it called? I can't remember. No.
Yeah, we're remaking From Dusk Till Dawn.
Are you? Okay.
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
It's good. I've been doing a lot of second unit the past couple of weeks. So I do principal like in the fall when it's not so hot because a lot of it takes place outdoors. And I don't want to be, you know, boiling in the dreaded south heat. And I don't want my equipment to get all kind of steamy. So we're going to wait till the fall when it cools down. Mm-hmm.
Steamy equipment. What kind of movie is this?
Yeah.
And I understand you
are very mindful.
Starring Stephen Jeffries.
Yes.
Oh, I met him too.
Uh-huh. Oh, you did?
And?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I met him once in the 90s, and I met him for 976 Evil Thing. And afterwards, this friend of mine was like, you know he makes gay porn, right? And I was like, no. And he loaned me this video because he happened to just have one of Stephen Jeffries' movies. So we watched it, and I was like, oh, my goodness. It was intense. But he's a really sweet guy, and it was really nice to meet him again. And I told him I met him in the 90s, and he seemed really pleased by that.
Oh, excellent. And Joseph, I think I saw on Facebook you said that you had some – well, you talked about Gory Graduation, about that is going to be going to production after the short. Is that right?
Yes. People ask if it's still going, and it's been a couple of years, but yes, it's still on the table, just in case you're wondering.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And Nathan, how about you? What have you been watching?
Well, first of all, Amanda is right. I have seen Sometimes Aunt Martha Does Dreadful Things. Amazing title, by the way.
Yes.
It's such a good title. It's been a really long time, but I do remember liking it, so I'll have to rewatch that sometime soon. And speaking of rewatching, what I rewatched this week was a little made-for-TV remake from 1988 called I Saw What You Did.
So good. It's so good.
It is, isn't it?
Yes.
I saw it when I was a kid, so I rewatched it this week. It was just, you know, by chance that I just happened to come across it. And I've always been a big fan of it because I just love the idea of, you know, these two high school girls are playing pranks on the phone and just, you know, calling people saying, I saw what you did and I know who you are. And they end up calling the wrong guy who's actually committed a murder. So, you know, it ends up being kind of a, you know, suspense type film between him and these two girls who, you know, for most of the movie are unaware of how dangerous he is. So I recommend it. And it's got Shawnee Smith in it.
It does. Wasn't it directed by Fred Walton, who did April Fool's Day?
Was he the one that directed it?
I think he did direct it. I can't remember, but I can open up my book and take a look while you're talking because I have it right here.
Have any of you guys seen it?
No. Yes.
Oh,
no.
I always thought it paired very well with Lisa from 1990. Oh.
Yeah,
this is really good too.
Yeah, it is.
This is Richard. I'm in your house, and I'm going to kill you. I love both of those films. I haven't seen I Saw What You Did in a long time. I kind of want to rewatch it now.
It is directed by Fred Walton. It's super stylish. That's what stuck out to me about it. Is it looks a little different than a lot of other TV movies, and I hate to say that, but it has a cinema quality to it for sure.
Does anyone see the original? Have you seen the original with Joan Crawford?
Oh yeah, yeah, it's good. Mm.
Did you?
William Castle. Is that William Castle?
Yeah, it is. William Castle. He did the original one. Mm.
Did you see the? Have you seen Feud yet, Amanda?
I haven't. You know what? We don't have cable, and so I just kind of look at what people are saying about it. But actually, my boss at my job actually recommended it to me too. Mm. So I'm hearing I need to sit down and watch it. I have a love-hate relationship with, so I kind of like. I'll watch her in things, but she's kind of groan-inducing to me in some ways. And so that was part of my apprehension. But if everybody says it's good, I'll try it out.
Well, there's a great scene. We're talking about William Castle because John Waters plays William Castle in the thing.
And, that's great.
And they do a screening. They've got this kind of set up the cinema for Homicidal. And they've got Jessica Lange playing Joan Crawford coming down the aisle swinging an axe lethargically. And John Waters is kind of... is on stage as William Castle, and she's talking to him and saying no more gimmicks, and then he brings out girls with hatchets throwing them into the audience. But she obviously liked it enough to go back and do I Saw What You Did. So just a little aside there. But
At the archive I work at, I just processed a collection that included letters from Joan Crawford to the person who owns the collection, and I read them. And I have a real soft spot for both actresses, but I don't know how true all the stories are about her and her daughter, although it makes good reading and cinema. But she was so nice in her letters. I mean, they were really, really sweet. And her daughter wrote a letter to this person as well. And I always picture Joan Crawford standing over the daughter, forcing her to write this really sweet letter, you know, because she's supposed to be this horrible person. But the person I see behind the scenes seems really sweet to me. So I don't know how much is true and how much isn't.
Well, I think from what I read, she was always she learned everyone's names on set and gave people little gifts and was very nice to everyone. But that was partly just to get her better parts and get her. So whether or not that was true or it was, you know, affection or I don't know. But
working it. Do you know have you guys seen Trog?
Yes, I love Trog.
So, you know, David Warbeck's in that, right? He has a very small part and he plays a reporter, which is the whole reason why I own that movie. And he was talking to Joan Crawford and behind the scenes, and he's like, God, this movie is horrible, Joan. He's like, well, how can you do this? And she said to him, and I quote, it is my job to turn shit into gold. Mm-hmm. And he said he carried that mantra with him throughout his entire career. And I never forgot that. Like, it's so true, because she was really good in those movies.
Mm. Well, it's half an episode of Feud is about Trog, about her making Trog.
Oh my God! Really?
Yeah. So yeah. It's got all of the, you know, she's on set and they've got someone dressed as Trog and they recreate a lot of the scenes from the movies, some of the later movies. So it's kind of half of it's her and about how her dressing room is like a sort of a truck or something, and she just kind of gets on with it. But yeah, it's really, really well done.
Who played David Warbeck?
I don't remember.
I don't think he's in it.
Jensen Ackles.
That would be good. But I think it's more of an incidental. It's more to do with, is it Freddie Francis who directed it? I think it's his relationship with her talking, you know. But yeah, that's definitely a thing. But Joseph, you're going to say something.
Oh, I was just going to say, I've not seen Feud. I kind of want to watch it. But from what I understand, they take some extreme artistic license with the truth. I think a lot of it didn't happen. That's what I've read. Mm. So I'm kind of apprehensive about it, but I still want to see it though.
I think it's just very well done. It's kind of, it does take some artistic license, and obviously a lot of it is based on the Divine Feud, which is a book, which was a lot of it's made up of anecdotes. So a lot of it wasn't true, but some of it probably was true.
I'm sure it's just an enhanced dramatization of what happened. So, but if I go into it looking at it like that, it'll probably be fine.
Yeah, I mean, it just looks great, and they do a lot of the just recreation of the Hack Horror stuff that they made after Baby Jane. So there's a lot of that. It's just very well, you know, from a horror movie and that kind of you know, it's stuff that's usually ignored in their kind of Bette Davis and Joan Crawford filmography. So just for that alone, it's definitely worth a watch. But
There's a lot of heart in that show too. I mean. It's kind of got like several scenes where you feel really, really bad for both of them.
Mm, absolutely.
You know, it's not, the movie doesn't, I mean, the show doesn't paint just one as a good guy and one as a villain. I think this is a good job of just painting them both as very flawed, you know, humans.
Which is probably accurate, wasn't it? I'm sure.
Yeah, I think so.
Excellent. Right. Well, thank you. Well, sorry, that was Joseph, wasn't it? Did we finish? Had you seen anything else?
Well, that was Nathan. But oh, I was Nathan, just going to say one more thing. If they ever, if we ever like get so famous in the future where they do like a docu drama on us, I can't wait to see how they kind of dramatize like you and Eric like feuding over Susie and Toya. Eric will be coming down some steps swinging a Kit Kat bar. And
yeah. Yep.
Saying, it's my job. It's my job to turn shit like Toya into gold.
Hey!
Hey!
My God! I just said you were my favorite at the start of the show, and now...
Eric, you know I love Toya.
Meep is my favorite now.
I'm just rib tickling you, buddy.
Well, I've got
that's pretty bad when Eric's not picking any of us from the Hysteria.
Yeah,
well, I can't pick.
I can't pick Justin because he bullies me all the time. I can't pick you because you're Amanda's favorite.
So I like Roger. Whatever happened to Roger?
More than one favorite.
I like Poochie.
What about Simon Logan?
Simon Logan. Yeah, there you go.
He's my favorite.
But anyways, Eric, I've got an extra special surprise for you at the end of the show.
Ooh. Mm. Is there something I can put in my mouth?
That's what I wanted, Justin.
No. Oh, Amanda.
You got to say, oh, Amanda, at least once, and really slow and deep.
Yeah. Oh, Amanda.
Slow and deep.
Thank you.
So, well, thank you. Nathan, is there anything else? Obviously, we don't want to set off the rhubarb lady.
Oh, you already asked me.
Yes, but
that was Joe that talked about what movie did we just talk about? I'm sorry, it's very early.
Oh, don't worry. Well, let's just move on to Eric, shall we? I think
he's okay. Wacky tobacco. Yeah. Okay. I saw Alien Covenant in the cinema this week.
Oh yeah.
So this is the sequel to Prometheus, and it didn't take the route that I thought it would. When I saw Prometheus, you know, if anyone has seen it, it ends on a certain type of cliffhanger, which makes you think the sequel is going to jet off in a certain direction. But this one, the first half of it is very much a standalone sequel, with an all-new crew of terraformers. They're en route to colonize a distant planet when they pick up a signal from a nearby planet, which looks like it might be even more suitable for human life, so they go and investigate. What I really did like this film, I have to say, but I should qualify that by saying that I also liked Prometheus, which I know a lot of people didn't like at all. I think a lot of people were let down by the 2012 movie. But this one, I think, irons out some of the flaws of Prometheus. First of all, it drops a number of threads that Prometheus initiated, which made that film kind of muddled. They're trying to cram too many ideas, I think, into Prometheus, which they're kind of eliminated in this one. The script is more cohesive. The characters aren't as stupid, although they still do classic horror movie things like going into dark rooms and, well, Justin, you go into lots of dark rooms as well when you're in bars, don't you?
I imagine that's more your forte, Eric.
I think probably the most important thing about this one for people who were let down by Prometheus is there's actual aliens in this one, and I mean you can see them blatantly in the trailers for the film. So it's the classic alien look. It's back. There's lots of gore, lots of action set pieces. In fact, there's one huge action set piece towards the end, which wouldn't be out of place in a Fast and Furious sequel. You know, it's almost Michael Bay-ish, but in a good way. And the downside is that the creature effects are mostly CGI, because the aliens in it are super fast. They zip around this planet's surface like cheetahs. So in a way, they're kind of like Alien 3, the alien in Alien 3, although the effects in Alien 3, because I was rewatching that recently as well, are appalling in certain scenes. But whereas in Alien Covenant, at least they're decent, but they are CGI because there's no real way to do them in any other way. I mean, there are some practical effects shots, but for the most part, they're CGI. The two scenes kind of stood out for me. There's a scene in the middle where, and this isn't a spoiler as such, Michael Fassbender plays two androids. He plays David from Prometheus, and he plays an updated version of that line of androids called Walter. And they come face to face sort of halfway through the film, and one of them teaches the other how to play the flute. And it includes the immortal line, "You blow and I'll do the fingering," which, of course, set off a ripple of chuckles throughout the cinema. Also, there's a bona fide slasher movie moment in it as well. And again, this is not a spoiler as it's in the trailer, but there's two people indulging in sins of the flesh in the shower. And a alien sort of interrupts their enjoyment as such. So overall, as a big fan of the Alien franchise, I was really pleased with the film. It delivered everything I wanted. It's nowhere near as good as the original, obviously, but there's it gets back to the basics, which is just monster mayhem action. There's some new ideas thrown in here and there, and halfway through the film it starts to link back a bit to Prometheus and ties up some of the loose ends that film left hanging. But I thought it was the bottom line is, I found it so entertaining that I didn't look at my watch once in the 2 hours. And the 2 hours seemed to zip by in about 15, 20 minutes, it felt like. So, but as I said, I'm a fan of Prometheus, so I might be not the best reference point for Alien Covenant, but I loved it.
Excellent. Anyone else seen that?
I do want to see it. I like parts of Prometheus, but for the most part, I thought it was like a big Gnostic wet fart.
Oh my goodness.
Yuck.
The Damon Lindelof, who did one of the versions of it, I think he did a lot of the writing on it. He just seems like so obsessed with like abiogenesis and this is how the world was created, and I don't care about that stuff. I mean, I like that stuff in a debate with people, but when I go see an alien film, I want to see, you know, aliens just kind of ripping people apart. So, you know, parts of Prometheus was good, but I think this one looks a lot better, so I do look forward to seeing it.
I don't know if I would like it because it's sci-fi, and I just...
It is quite sci-fi.
I'm not a big fan of sci-fi, really, except Jason X, probably the best sci-fi movie.
I think that's probably the only time anyone has ever said Jason X is the best sci-fi movie. Only you could say something like that, Nathan.
It's entertaining.
This is why you would have been my favorite if it wasn't for the fact that I can't. Yeah.
Well, I do believe we'll have a Friday the 13th this year, so you'll get to talk about it soon.
Yes.
Eric, there's a Kit Kat in it for you if I'm your favorite.
Oh, you're my favorite again.
I'll just get Justin a few dry martinis.
Well, you're my favorite.
I want to be everyone's least favorite. That's my mission in life, is to be everyone's least favorite.
Well, how can you be the least favorite?
Yeah.
It's easy. Just hate everybody and hope they hate me.
Be an emo.
Yeah, there you go.
The emo is the first step, Joe.
Now, see, what I like about Joe is I like his very dry, like, even when he's joking, it comes across very dry, and I like dry wit.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Nathaniel.
Yes, what a loving,
I like his big willy.
Oh. Well, it is
there
big.
There we go.
I agree with that, so. That's well, about that... the only good thing I have going for me these days.
Aww.
Well, on that bombshell, I shall...
I can't respond to that.
Yeah. Well, I'll talk about what I've been watching.
Amanda is that I think she's gorgeous inside and out.
Aw, yes. And my big willy.
Have you seen...
She's Angela from Sleepaway Camp. Yeah.
Have you seen inside her, Nathan?
That explains it. You know, my immediate attraction.
Right. Well, okay. On that second bombshell, I should talk a little bit about what I watched a couple of things. One was on Netflix. It was it just caught my eye. It was a new film called Clinical, and part of the reason actually was because it starred somebody who was in Home Sweet Home, the 1981 slasher. It was Vanessa Shaw, who played the little girl in Home Sweet Home, very badly if you remember that movie. But in this, she's much better because she's... Well, she did.
I love that movie.
But she was pretty rubbish. Well, she's quite funny in it. But anyway, in this movie, she's playing...
It's not funny as Mistake.
No, that's true. But this movie was kind of... she's playing a psychiatrist who dealt with trauma victims. And it starts at the right beginning of the movie. It's not a spoiler, but one of her patients kills herself, attacks her and leaves her kind of slashed up, but also then cuts her own throat. And then years later, she's recovering. She starts doing counselling again, and she starts counselling a guy who's had a face transplant. But she starts seeing visions of the young girl who killed herself, or did she? And so it could have been amazing. It could have been really, really good trashy fun, and the bits of it were really good and fun. But it was a bit drawn out, a bit ponderous. It goes into kind of slasher movie territory towards the end. And reminded a little bit about the ending of Don't Go to Sleep, I guess probably it's only just come on Netflix. So people haven't seen that, but it's anyone seen it?
I saw that on Netflix. I didn't watch it, but it's in my queue, so I am going to watch it.
Yeah, it's all right, but it's nothing special. It could have been much better. I think if it had just been a bit trashier and a little less ponderous, it could have been fantastic. But the other film I saw, I think I mentioned last time, I had from the film was Soul Station, which is the prequel, the animated prequel to Train to Busan, which is the new zombie classic. And it's really good. It's really kind of well done. And it's basically, it's a prequel, literally. It's kind of the day before, on the lead up to zombie outbreak in Seoul, in South Korea. But it's much darker than Train to Busan. It's a lot dark. You know, Train to Busan's a fun, zippy, zombie movie with some heart and, sort of very exciting action scenes, whereas the prequel is very, very dark. It's kind of like the main protagonist is a young woman who's been pimped out by a boyfriend and finds herself homeless just as a zombie outbreak breaks out, and she's being hunted or searched for by her father, who may or may not have abused her. So as you can see, it's already quite a dark sort of thing, but it's definitely worth a watch if you're a fan of Korean, South Korean movies and zombie films and anime as well. It's worth a watch.
I am really, really tired of zombie films, but everyone keeps saying Train to Busan is like really good. Mm. So should I watch it?
Oh, absolutely. It's the best zombie movie I've seen in years. Definitely. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well then, okay. I'll watch that tonight then.
Yeah.
I got a question. I hate anime. So do you think I could get into this film? Because I like zombies, but I don't care for anime.
Well, the difference between anime, an example, we watched A Letter to Momo, which was an anime from, I don't know, sort of mid-late 2000s, about a little girl who makes friends with goblins. And it's kind of like a lot of Japanese anime anyway, is a lot of it is that kind of cutesy kind of like stuff, which I quite like. But this is a zombie horror movie, an animated zombie horror movie, basically. So it's not it's a very different type of anime. So
Letters to Momo, is that like a Stormtroopers of Death song sequel or something?
Not quite. No, not unless you've got like sort of it's very cutesy. It's
Justin,
fun.
I have a question.
Yes,
I'm both sexy and brilliant. Would I like Train to Busan?
Well, I can't. I find it difficult to process the first part of the question, but I think you might like the film. Yes.
And earlier, Justin, did you say zombies in Seoul?
In Seoul, that Seoul is kind of the capital of South Korea.
Seoul, South Korea.
Oh, sort of like your soul.
Not like soul, not like Soul, Soul Train or Northern Soul or kind of, you know, Sister Sledge.
Oh, okay.
You know, like an underground rickshaw to soul right now.
Sister Sledge are more disco, in fairness.
That's true, actually.
I'm hearing you.
That's true. So, okay. But anyway, well, let's talk a little bit about some TV movie slashers, so shall we? Because we have with us, as we already know, Amanda Reyes, who is the editor, and
she's here, actually,
of the book.
I'm very much like a wallflower.
But well, no, we don't believe that, Amanda. But Are You in the House Alone? Growing Up with Gargoyles, Giant Turtles, Valerie Harper, The Cold War, Stephen King, and Coed Cool Girls, a TV movie compendium from 1964 to 1999. So, both myself and Eric have got a copy of the book, and I think Joseph and Nathan, you've either got one or you're going to be picking one up shortly. And
I do have one.
Oh, you do have it. Excellent. So, Nathan.
Yes.
Thank you. Consider...
I placed an order, but it's not here yet, unfortunately.
Sure. Okay.
I placed an order on Amazon, got it the very next day. That was awesome.
Yeah.
So. I've got an autographed copy by the author.
So have I. But enough about us.
I'll get Amanda to sign mine the next time I meet her. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, next time he can actually say he's going to a convention and show up at one.
Yeah. Stuff always happens. I want to go so bad, and then, like, right now, it's just so much financial crap.
I know. I was just hoping you could make this last con. We had a great time.
Texas is super duper far away from Nathan and Joseph.
It's like a 10-hour drive, maybe 11-hour drive.
Whoa, that's
or like a 3-hour flight. Okay. I think you guys should fly there next year. And we'll all go and meet up.
I'd like to do that definitely. If we can, like, let's get a fundraiser going.
Yes, I will start a fundraiser if people will fund it. They won't, but I'll do it anyway.
Yeah,
for us to go to a convention.
I'll tell you what, I'll start a fundraiser. If you do that, we'll do a video cast and while we're in the hotel, and we'll upload it.
I want a bigger television, so I'm going to start a fundraiser for that.
There you go.
Oh, Eric, don't spoil it. Come on, we've got to create the illusion.
Let's talk about Amanda's book.
Yes, Amanda's book. Yeah. So, Amanda, you were in London when we met with you, and you'd done a lecture, hadn't you, about TV movies, kind of launching your book. What's the reception been like? No, so to say,
it was good, you know. So I did a launch in, I talked to you guys last time, I was in Australia, and I was really surprised by how open to TV movies and how popular they were, not like super popular, but like that people had seen enough of them to have a context and a background and that they actually enjoyed them in another country. And so I've heard mixed things about England in terms of, excuse me, my cold is kicking in terms of the access to TV movies. A lot of them came out theatrically, I think, like I think you guys got a Salem's Lot cut, and I know Gargoyles had some kind of European release and Terror at London Bridge, but like I wasn't sure if anybody had really seen any. And I did this interview with Chris Brown over at the last horror movie podcast, and he didn't really have a lot of background on TV movies at all. And so I wasn't sure what I was going into. So I did just a general overview of the TV movie. And then I actually like took the larger horror genre, and then I boiled it down into a couple of different sub genres within the supernatural. So I talked about paranormal films and second wave feminism, and I also talked about grief in the haunted house ghost story movies, and I talked about Don't Go to Sleep, and we'll talk about that later. And then Kayla Janice, who wrote House of Psychotic Women, who runs the Miskatonic Institute, who had me as a guest, she did a thing on travel terror. So she talked a lot about there were a lot of movies about hijackings and things like that in planes, because that was a big thing in the 70s, and she talked about that. And then Jennifer Wallace, who's also in the book, talked about rape and rape response in the TV movie. And, you know, we almost sold out of the book. We only had one copy left. And only a couple people came up to me after the show, which was interesting, but I got some pretty good feedback from people who emailed me and left comments on the page that the Miskatonic has on Facebook. And so, yeah, it went really well. I think the TV movie is more popular than I had anticipated. They seem to have some general background in it. But at the same time, I think, like in Australia, people see TV movies as just movies, which kind of maybe puts them at a better standing point. They're not as maligned in the sense that they're just seen as American films, not as American made for TV films. And here the TV movie is, you know, I mean, I've heard you guys say it on the show, and that's not a knock against anybody, but I've heard people, when you do your like recently seen or whatever, you say, well, it looked like a TV movie. And you know, when people say that, that's like a negative. And I think in foreign countries that that's not a thing for them. So, what was your question? Yeah, it went really well. It went really well.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad to hear it. And so you can pick it up. Is it just released in the States, or can people pick it up? I mean, because it's by Head Press, isn't it? Which I think is that an American publishing?
No, they're British. One.
Yeah. It's British, isn't it? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, they're British. Jennifer is actually married to David, who runs Head Press, and he was there, which was great. I would love meeting him. He's been such a great cheerleader for me. Yeah, it's available in hardcover through Head Press, but I think it's available everywhere in paperback, just through Amazon. So, and it's pretty affordable. I think here it's only like $16 or $17. I don't know what that means in pounds, but yeah, anybody can order it from wherever, as far as I know.
Excellent, excellent, and a very good read it is too. I was reading some of the beginning of the book again this morning, and just sort of seeing your discussion about how popular the films were at the time when they were coming out. In so much they, you know, when they sort of saying about people watching, you know, The Walking Dead, and saying it's got the massive viewing figures, but back in the '70s, because there are only like three or four. Kind of stations in the States, wasn't there, in the early 70s, that people, I think, was it the highest? It's a Night Stalker, got something like 33 million people watching it.
Oh, yeah, it was ridiculous. Like, the ratings were so different than they are now, because everything's so fractured with cable and also now streaming and Netflix, that, like, you know, I don't know if you guys remember a TV show that was out a few years ago called Fringe. It was sort of like an X-Files riff. And that was on for a few years, and it had a really loyal cult following, but I don't think they got more than like 2 or 3 million people watching. And if that had happened in 1970, that show would have had like one episode, because that means like nobody watched it. And those sound like, those are kind of solid numbers now, and to some degree. And so, like, there was a movie called The Feminist and the Fuzz. I always refer back to this movie because I think it's so fascinating, but like, almost 50% of America watched that movie the night it aired, and it had a 46% share, which means 46% of houses that had televisions were watching something called The Feminist and the Fuzz. And now that movie is like lost. Like, you can Google it, and I'm sure it shows up somewhere online, but like, it's not a movie that people ever talk about anymore. But when you think about it, like, 30 to 40 million people were watching that movie. And now there's no access to it at all that's legal. You know what I mean? It's so weird that that happens. So a lot of these movies, like, there's over 5,000 TV movies, all genres, since 1964. And I'll go up to 1999 because I don't really do the 2000 so much. But, like, I would say, like, maybe 10% of them are available in any kind of legal format. And a lot of them are just lost. Like, there's this movie called, and I'm not even sure it's a movie, but it's called Sorority Kill. And I feel like it was made for late night television. It stars Anthony Geary, who played Luke Spencer on General Hospital. And it was directed by Gloria Monty, who would go on to produce General Hospital. And why are you laughing?
I was just thinking of Anthony Geary and UHF. I have to go to the planet Zarkon. Sorry.
He's the best. So, but he met Gloria Monty making Sorority Kill, and she remembered him when she was casting the part of Luke Spencer. And of course, that became like one of the most famous iconic soap opera characters in the history of television. But it's this weird little movie about like this group of people holding sorority sisters kidnapped, you know, hostage in a sorority house. And I can't find it anywhere. Like, I can barely find that it exists, except for the fact that Anthony Geary has mentioned it on his website, and a couple of promo images have surfaced since, like, 2005. And it's like these movies are genuinely lost, like hardcore gone. And so part of my job, I guess, is that I give to myself, is that I want to, like, preserve these films in some way. So I've realized that, like, I have a blog, right, called Made for TV Mayhem, and I've had it for about a decade, and I write a lot. I have well over 500 posts, but, like, I don't write a lot about the classics. Like, I haven't never done a full review of, like, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, which is one of my all-time favorite TV movies. But I like to write about movies that, like, are just movies you might not have ever heard of before. Like, I just recently wrote about something called Strange Homecoming with Robert Culp that was really good. And it's like, who's taking care of these movies? Because I don't even know that the networks know if they still have copies of them in their vaults. You know what I mean? And so it's really important to me. This is a whole history that's missing in, you know, studies and just in our general knowledge of television. And I'd like to see more attention put on it. And I'd like to see more of these movies made available to the general public.
Well, fantastic. One movie
that,
job.
One TV movie that I wanted to ask you about, Amanda. I've only given your book a cursory glance so far because I've been so busy, but there's one TV movie that no one believes exists, and I know it exists. It's The Peanut Butter Solution. Did you mention that in your book?
I didn't, but I know that movie. I've never seen it. I didn't even know that was a TV movie. Is Elon Mitchell Smith in that from Weird Science?
I think so. Basically, it's about a kid who's got, I think he had like leukemia or something, and he comes up with this like this hair growth stuff made from peanut butter or something like that. And there's, because I remember we watched it in school for some reason. I don't know why, but so the one kid, like, he sees that it makes his hair grow back, so his friend puts it on its crotch, and his hair grows out on its crotch really long. And I keep telling people about that, and they're like, that's not a real movie. And I'm like, it is a real movie.
I remember that movie. It's totally a real movie because if I'm remembering right, it wasn't leukemia. Like, the kid saw something that scared him so bad his hair fell out.
Okay, yeah.
It was kind of a joke that, you know, he got scared that badly. And then I think at the end they confront whatever it was that scared him or something. Good movie.
Okay. And another movie I wanted to ask you about, and no one seems to believe me that it exists, and I could be wrong on the title, but I think it's called Conrad. It's about a boy who gets mailed to people who are adopting a boy, and they grow him in like a box, and so they mail him to him, and then he grows out like a test tube or something like that. It's called Conrad or Conrack. Man, I can't find anyone who believes that movie exists, but I know I've seen it. It was on.
This is what happens. So, like, people are like, oh, wow, you write about TV movies. Have you heard of this or seen this? And it's always something I've never seen. And I'm like, shit. And then I have to usually pretend like I've seen it. Oh, yeah, that had so-and-so in it. But I don't know that one. But, you know, there's, like sometimes also there's, like, I don't know if you guys have movie mashups in your mind, but for years I remembered a movie very clearly about a man dressed up like a woman stabbing people in the basement of this house. And I was actually mixing up two different films. I was mixing up a Thriller episode, Brian Clemens' Thriller, Dial a Deadly Number, with Scream Pretty Peggy. And it took me years to extract the two memories and realize that I was actually thinking of two separate films. And then I was able to finally see them and realize that. But, like, the movie you're thinking of sounds like one very linear thought, but I had never heard of that.
Okay, one more thing. I assume you have watched a lot of those after-school specials.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Do you remember one? There's a boy, he's like mentally handicapped, and these kids pick on him. And it almost seems like one of the Dillon brothers is in it, but I could be wrong. But basically at the end, they're at this construction site or something, and one of the bullies, like, his arm gets broken, so the mentally handicapped boy, like, carries him to the hospital, and the lesson is, see, even mentally handicapped people are helpful. It's kind of bad. Like, that's the moral message of the film, but no one believes me that film exists either, and I know it's an after-school special because we watched that in school at one point.
I remember you asking about this on my blog's Facebook page, and I can't remember if we found a solution for you or not. Because I think I pulled up a picture of, it was a movie with, like, I can see the kid in my head, but I can't remember his name. It was someone like Jay Underwood, who always plays mentally retarded people, because that's just how he looked. And it was like a baseball team. I know that's horrible, but whatever.
Yeah.
It was a baseball team, and I think that's the closest I could find for you. But we should repost that, because I have a lot of new members now, and they're really on it, and they could probably help you find those last two for sure.
Okay. Yeah. And if anyone knows, then do write in and let us know. So thank you. I just kind of going into talk about the small screen TV slashers. Well, the other thing you said in your book in introduction was that there's two things. One was that stuck with me. One was that the TV makers, the people who are making these films or commissioning these films, were very much keeping an eye on the exploitation genre and the horror genre to see what was hot at the cinema, so they could do a small screen version of it, which obviously leads into why the slasher movie would have made an appearance on the small screen. But as also saying, of course, one of the problems, in inverted commas, of the slasher movie on the small screen, or any kind of horror movie outside a ghost story or something, is that you couldn't show explicit violence on the small screen. Or very small flashes of it, so they would come out with outrageous titles So to sort of kind of get people to watch the films, even though they didn't always deliver. But I mean, do you think, just as to start the conversation on this before we go into Don't Go to Sleep, do you think the slasher movie works on the small screen?
You know, that's a good question, because the closest I think the TV movie ever got to a true slasher was Deadly Lessons, which came out in 1983 and had Bill Paxton in it and Diane Franklin and Ally Sheedy. And, you know, I don't really care for that film myself so much. And I don't know if it's because they couldn't go as far as they could if, say, they had been able to make it as a theatrical, or if it's just not a very well-made movie. And I hate to say that because I love the director. I think it's William Wired who directed it. But they could play with the genre. And so I'm going to bring up a movie here. I know Joe's seen it, and I know Justin's seen it. I don't know if Eric and I think Nathan hasn't seen it. It's called Fantasies with Suzanne Plouchette.
And yeah, I had seen it
on my site. I uploaded it to my site like 6 years ago because I found a copy. I've lost it, but I have seen it.
It's a pretty lost film, but I'll just briefly go into it because I'm so fascinated by this movie. And that's because for several different reasons. So what it is it's Susan, and you've reviewed it, Justin, so people can read the full review on your site. And I've reviewed it a couple places myself as well. It's one of my all-time favorite TV movies. But so Suzanne Plouchette is a divorced woman who creates a nighttime soap called Midland USA. And she's got this cast, which is actually populated by real-life soap stars playing soap stars in this nighttime soap, which is really meta and interesting. And there's this guy who is really upset about something that's happening on the soap, so he actually starts killing off the cast members. And it really blurs the lines of what is fantasy and what is fiction, in the terms of that it's using real-life soap actors as fictional soap actors, and it's also following them in their day-to-day activities in certain scenes. So you're seeing, like, for instance, Robin Mattson, who plays Heather on General Hospital. In this movie, she's like one of the top stars on the show, and she goes to a grocery store. I think it's her character, and somebody starts harassing her at a store for like some kind of love relationship she's on in the show. And they can't really tell the difference between where her character stops and where the person starts. And that's very true with soaps. And so there's an actor in it named Robert S. Woods, who played Beau Buchanan One Life to Live for many years, and I got to talk to him on a podcast once, and I asked him about being in the film, and he told me that at the time when he was on One Life to Live, he was working with an actor, I can't remember his name, but he played Marco Dane, Gerald Anthony, and Gerald Anthony said, "I don't want you to make this movie, it's going to give people ideas." And what's so interesting is that even though it's kind of like this, it's a slasher because they're killing these actors in very slasher-like ways, obviously restrained for television, but the impetus of the creation of the TV movie came from several different real-life stories, and that was the assassination of John Lennon, the real-life rape that occurred with a 9-year-old girl after two girls saw Born Innocent and wanted to recreate the plunger scene. Not kidding, that really happened. And the third one was a boy who killed an older couple because he said violence on television influenced him to become violent himself, and there was this huge court case about it. And so the screenwriter, David Levinson, I think is his name, took all of these stories and he distilled them into this really superficial, glossy-looking movie that plays with all these different ideas of, I don't know, I guess meta is the only word I can use to it. It's trying to blur the lines of fact and fantasy in a lot of different ways. And so to me, slashers, straight slashers on television might not always be super effective because of that, but then you can take the structure of a slasher and you can sort of play it in like these weird and interesting ways. And I think Fantasies probably does it better than any other TV movie I can think of. Now, I say that, and a lot of people who love slashers deeply are going to see Fantasies and might be a little disappointed in it because it doesn't have all of that overt sex and violence in it. But I think if you're interested in sort of the blueprint and how you can mess around with it, I think that's a really good example of how to make a small screen slasher effective. I think it can work, but I don't know that you can do it as a straight blueprint. I think you have to mess around with the convention.
I think one good exception to the rule would be Home for the Holidays, which
for sure
is pretty violent for the time, especially considering it's a TV movie. But talking about Fantasies, I don't want to spoil anything because in case that film ever does come to light and more people can see it, I don't want to be, held responsible for spoiling it, but I just wanted to say that I think the ending is very clever, especially for the, for being a TV film and
the
time period.
Yeah. Yeah, for very sure. Clever. It definitely has a very self-aware quality to it that really stands out now that we're sort of in this postmodern age. And I totally agree with that. And to comment on Home for the Holidays, Joe is actually right. That's a fairly straight slasher too. But something that film does, and I guess Deadly Lessons did, and some of these movies on this list that I can go into, is that, you know, TV was marketing itself to women. So women were always the largest demographic that the networks were interested in, because more women watched television because that's just what they did. And so the most desirable demographic was women aged 18 to 49. And so TV movies were actually largely made for women. And when you look at a movie like Home for the Holidays, or alternatively something like Five Desperate Women, or Deadly Lessons, or She's Dressed to Kill, is you're going to see slashers or proto-slashers that play like slashers, but are run by female ensembles. So men really take a back seat to females in the casting and in the placement of, you know, the leadership in the roles. So they're also still playing with convention in the sense that they're trying to attract a female audience by using a genre that is largely considered male, although I would argue slasher movies are largely generated for a female audience, and anybody who's read Blood Money might agree with me. But even within that structure that is fairly faithful, they're still, of course, the map hadn't been made yet, but they're still doing something different. And so as a woman watching Home for the Holidays, I think it's a really scary film, but it also has this really interesting female dynamic that I relate to, and that's what the filmmakers were shooting for when they made that.
Cool.
I would agree. I was just going to say, sorry, Justin, I think as far as the violence and pushing the envelope for Home for the Holidays, it's a little out there. I don't know, kill me if you must, but I always found the drama in Home for the Holidays as it pertains to the women a little melodramatic. I don't know.
Oh, it's just I'll me. Kill you.
Well, melodrama is a huge part of the gothic, right? And
yeah,
a lot of these movies are gothic in senses of like location, and or the damsel in distress. You know, it has a lot of qualities that play that way. And I would say that a lot of these movies are melodramatic. I talk about tonight, although I find it really effective. But I think you're right. There is a lot of melodrama. But you know, as a female audience too, you know, soap operas are largely driven by male audience and. Something I love, obviously, soap operas. And so I agree, they're melodrama, and I can see where people might watch a slasher. And with a few exceptions, there are some that transcended genre, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow being one of them, but not finding them as satisfying because of that, because they are more character driven. And I don't think you have a problem, Joe, with character driven films, but it's the way they drive the characters that I think you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Okay. Mm. Well, did you want to talk? Is there any others that you wanted to bring up, Amanda, before we go on to like a case in point, which obviously Don't Go to Sleep is along those lines in so much it certainly borrows from the slasher movie toy box, but it, in itself, and has a structure of a slasher movie, doesn't it? In so much that it's like deaths every sort of 15, 20 minutes of the running time. Although not particularly graphic, although it's probably the first film with a point of view shot of an iguana, but
the iguana cam is my favorite part of that movie. I have so many movies here. I will say that Nathan and my other podcasting partner Dan Budnick and I are going to be talking about two slashers. This just kind of happened without me realizing we were going to be talking about Don't Go to Sleep. We're going to be talking about Five Desperate Women and She's Dressed to Kill on our next episode. So I won't go into those too much, but those are pretty straight proto-slashers. Although I will say Five Desperate Women is really light. And I know Nate's talked about it on this show. I think he saw it years ago and mentioned it. It's slasher light, but it definitely has a proto-slasher feel to it. But there's some really interesting films that play with the conventions. Another one that I remember Nate mentioning, and he wasn't as hip on it, was something called Isn't It Shocking? With Alan Alda and Louise Lasser, which is a really interesting film because it's about older people getting murdered, which is still pretty taboo. And it's about this guy who's retired, and he comes back to this his old small town, and he starts knocking off his classmates who are now in their 60s and 70s, and Ruth Gordon is the final girl. And speaking of Don't Go to Sleep, and it's so fascinating because she's fucking old, you know what I mean? And like, And, like, she's the final girl, and I've never seen anything like it before in my life. But I remember something Nathan said about the film is that he didn't like the police procedural of it. And so that's something else about TV movies I think might turn people off. And I'm not trying to turn people off of looking at TV movies, but maybe preparing them if they haven't seen a lot of them, is that you're going to see a lot of stuff, a lot of B-roll, I guess you want to call it, because they can't dive as deeply into, you know, the gore and the murders. So they make up for it with, you know, police stories and, like, different character stories that I personally find compelling. But I think that that's a really interesting film. It's super quirky. A lot of it's ad-libbed, I think, the dialogue between Alan Alda and Louise Lasser. And it's kind of shocking because we still don't see movies with geriatric, you know, killings to that extent anyway. Another interesting movie, and I don't remember it as well as I should, but one that I loved is called Winter Kill with Andy Griffith. That's available through Warner Archives. That's a really, really interesting. I can't even remember who the killer is now, but it's got a lot of really scary death scenes in it. And I like it because something else that TV movies facilitated, which I talked about briefly in my book, is that actors who were known for one type of role like to use the TV movie as a launching pad for removing themselves from sort of that pigeonholing. So Elizabeth Montgomery did it with The Legend of Lizzie Borden. And, you know, everybody saw that and was like, oh, my God, I can't believe that was her. Farrah Fawcett did it, you know, obviously, with The Burning Bed and Small Sacrifices. Andrew Griffith did it, and Robert Reed did it better than anybody, with maybe the exception of John Ritter. But Andrew Griffith was really good at playing characters that were so far removed from the Andy Griffith Show. Savages, which I put on my list because it's not really a slasher, but it's kind of like a stalking film where he goes out on a hunting trip. He's this rich guy and he hires this guide played by one of the Bottoms brothers. I can't remember which one now, Sam Bottoms maybe. And he accidentally kills this homeless guy and Sam Bottoms finds out and he wants to go tell the authorities. So Andy Griffith doesn't want to be discovered and get in trouble, so he drags Sam Bottoms out into the middle of the desert and leaves him there to his own devices. And then not only just leaves him there hoping that he'll just bake and die in the sun, but he like sets up camp and follows him and watches him and like hangs out while Sam Bottoms is trying to get out of the desert. And it's not a slasher at all, but it's got that stalking scene. But it's an example of Andy Griffith's like using horror films, TV movies as a way to get out of the pigeonhole. And so Winter Kill is the closest I think he came to making a slasher that I can think of off the top of my head. There was Terror at the London Bridge, which I think Justin's seen.
I've seen that one.
Yeah, I think you may have reviewed it. I really like that movie. It's with David Hasselhoff, you know, who's somehow Jack the Ripper has come back to life. And he died on the London Bridge, and then somebody in Arizona buys the London Bridge and has it shipped over, which is a true story. And somehow the essence of Jack the Ripper comes to life and starts stalking people in Lake Havasu. And it's like super outrageous in the premise, but it's really straight-faced in the performances and in the way it's structured and played off. And I think it's really charming. I don't know how popular it is with people in general, but it's got Rosemary, it's got Adrian Barbeau, it's got Stephanie Kramer, Randall Mantooth, Clu Gulager. I mean, it's a really great, like, a fun, weird movie. And I actually saw that in the theater. That had a European release, and somebody found a print of it, and they played it in L.A. at a Clu Gulager tribute with Hunter's Blood and Nightmare on Elm Street 2. So that was really, really fun. I'm trying to think what else I haven't mentioned. There's a couple movies that I haven't seen that I want to just briefly talk about because I think they might be slashers and maybe you guys have heard of them or seen them. One is called Drive Hard, Drive Fast with Joan Collins. It's about a race car driver who finds himself in a romantic triangle and with a machete swinging stranger who's trying to kill him. Has anybody seen this?
It's got Joan Collins in it.
Yeah. It's from the early 70s, and I've seen promo stills from it, but I can't find a copy of it. I do know it exists somewhere on a film print, but a private collector has it.
Hmm. So speaking of Bottoms, Eric, have you not seen that?
No.
No.
It's top of my list, though.
Okay, that's good. And
More thing I wanted to ask Amanda before we move into Don't Go to Sleep is, sorry, and this is not a slasher, but it is a made-for-TV film. Did you happen to mention the name escapes me right now, but the Richard Crenna film where he's the misogynist cop who gets raped?
Yeah, that's The Rape of Richard Beck. That's a great film.
Yeah, okay.
That's an interesting film, too. That's something else. Well, so television, so in the Miskatonic talk, you know, Jennifer talked a lot about rape response because the, you know, TV is actually one of the first places to tackle topical issues. And so, like, rape in the 70s, you know, was a really big issue because it started to become sort of more of a news item, I think, because women were becoming more comfortable with coming out with being assaulted. And so there were several films that came out that addressed this in a number of different ways. But then in the 80s, The Rape of Richard Beck came out. And so what they did was it was about a cop, like Joe said, a misogynist who basically, like, treats women like shit, and, like, rape victims, he's like, well, and he does all the stereotypes. Well, what was she wearing? You know, blah, blah, blah. And then he finds himself in a situation where he gets assaulted by these two guys, and then he becomes the victim, and it's about his awareness of how women have been treated. And it was directed by a woman. It was directed by Karen Arthur, who may have acted something about Amelia, which is that incest movie with Ted Danson. And it's actually a really, really good film. And I like that TV did that kind of stuff. And actually, I was going to talk about a movie Valerie Harper made about rape later, so we can talk about that. But just to get back to slashers, there's one more. There's a few films I want to bring up real quickly, but there's one more that I haven't seen. I have a copy of it that I think might be a slasher. It's called The Girl on the Late Late Show, which is about a television producer decides to find out the whereabouts of a former movie actress whose career has long since faded. He discovers that his inquiries have set off a string of murders. It stars Don Murray. Has anybody seen this?
Not heard of it, no.
No.
It sounds really, really good. I have had a copy for years. I just haven't gotten around to watching it. So I moved it up to the top of my list. But I also want to mention that there's a couple films that also riff on the giallo. There's one called Honeymoon with a Stranger, which I just saw with Janet Leigh, which is an amazing, quirky little film that came out in 1969 about a woman who is traveling Spain, or maybe she's in another country, and she ends up getting married to this, like, kind of really rich guy, played by Cesar de Nova. And I think he's, or maybe he's the guy that shows up later. So anyway, she gets married to this guy and he's really rich, and she goes to his, like, villa in Spain, and he goes out one night and a different man comes back. Maybe that's Cesar de Nova. And she's like, you're not my husband. And nobody believes her. So she goes to the police, and there's this whole, like, unraveling of what's happened to her husband in the, like, 24 hours he was missing. And it's really fun. And Janet Leigh is amazing in it. And it doesn't have, obviously, all that, like, sort of sexuality that the giallo has. And it doesn't have a lot of murder in it. But it has, like, the, you know, the really fabulous locations and the whodunit and the police procedural in there. And it's really charming. I love that it was shot in Spain. They use a lot of foreign actors. I feel like Uyo Payali might be in it, somebody like that. And there was another one that I haven't seen yet with Barbara Eden called The Woman Hunter with Stuart Whitman. And I think Stuart Whitman is stalking Barbara Eden in some fabulous, like, resort. And it's got all kinds of, like, 70s fashion. And I believe that's a riff on the giallo. And it was written by Brian Clemens, who did the Thriller series in England. And just a couple other, I guess, wannabe slashers. I know that Justin's seen this one because he reviewed it. No Place to Hide with Kathleen Beller is a really good, like, slasher wannabe that kind of riffs on Prom Night in the first 20 minutes. It's got a killer that sort of does that same whisper where he's like, you know, where the killer says, now. And he's like, he says, soon, Amy, soon. And it's sort of a gaslighting thriller, but then it's got these really great stalking scenes in it. And it's got a final girl transformation as well that I think is really interesting. And then there's something called Someone's Watching Me, which was directed by John Carpenter. And he did it right after he did Halloween with Lauren Hutton and Adrian Barbeau about a woman who's being stalked by a stranger in an apartment complex. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen both of those, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, they're both really, really good. And I don't know. It's hard to, like, classify. How do you classify a slasher, right? Because Someone's Watching Me definitely has more murder in it, but I don't know that it's a slasher, but it's got these elements of a slasher running through it. Plus, it was directed by John Carpenter, you know what I mean, right after he did Halloween. And then there's a really, really good one called The Girl Most Likely To, and I'm sort of putting in the slasher genre just so I can talk about it. But it was written by Joan Rivers, and it stars Dakar Channing as an ugly duckling girl at college who can't get anybody to like her, and she can't get anything to go her way. And she gets in a car accident, and while she's she's in a body cast. She loses all this weight, and they have to give her plastic surgery, and she comes out this really beautiful woman. And so she goes back to the college where everybody treated her like shit, and she picks them off one by one. And at the same time, Ed Asner plays this police detective who's trying to catch her, and he falls in love with her brilliant mind. And it's this like really, really dark comedy with these really great creative deaths in it. Like she makes the cheerleader do a backflip out the window to her death and stuff like that. And it's a really, really fun movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh man, the cheerleader, like she's played by the blonde that was in The Baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love her character in this movie because she's so stupid. I mean, she's such a bimbo. And then to get basically tricked into doing backflips out the window is just so ridiculous. But it's a really, really fun movie.
Nathan, what was the made-for-TV movie that you were looking for that had Terry Garr in it? I think it was a slasher film.
It's not a slasher, but it's a murder mystery. It was, and Amanda might have it, actually, because we talked about that not long ago, but it's called A Quiet Little Neighborhood, A Perfect Little Murder.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I do. I have it on VHS.
It's one of those made-for-TV movies I saw when I was a kid, and I just loved it and watched it over and over again. It's the basic plot line is Terry Garr and Robert Urich. Yum.
yes.
but yeah, so she has one of those like baby monitors. It looks like a clown. And she overhears like some neighbors plotting a murder. And it's sort of a dark comedy, actually, more so than like a suspense movie. It's more on the, you know, funny side, I'd say. But she basically gathers together anybody in the, you know, within like a certain mile radius of her house that shares the names of the two people that are in the murder plot. And the whole rest of the movie is her trying to figure out which, you know, Dawn and Judy are conspiring against someone else. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, we've had that. We have that on our to watch list for hopefully soon. I think we're going to do a Robert Urich double at some point because, you know, Robert Urich.
Yeah, that's enough said.
Excellent. Well, I know we've got some. There's quite a few connections, obviously, with Valerie Harper and the TV slasher movie, isn't there? With well, kind of along those same lines. So, what do you think? Should we kind of cut to the movie, or cut to the talking about this? And obviously, we can talk more about TV slashers as we go in comparison to Don't Go to Sleep. Does that sound good to everyone?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, I hunted high and low, but I couldn't find a
like aha.
I like aha. Yes, exactly. Like aha. But I couldn't find a TV spot for Don't Go to Sleep. So on YouTube, although if you do want to watch the film, it's a film that's very elusive. It's not out officially, as Amanda said, many of these films aren't. But it is. There's many copies of it on YouTube. So if you did want to watch it, then it is available on YouTube. But here is some dialogue from the film. So, and I'll bring you back in with an introduction to it just after this.
I do want us to be together.
Well, it doesn't look too good right now. They're selling the house.
Good. It's depressing here.
You think it's depressing here? Wait till you see where they send you when they move.
What do you mean?
You don't think they're taking you with them, do you? Why do you think they're moving to a smaller house? Because you're not going to be with them. You're going to be put in the nut house.
That's one place I'm not going to.
What makes you think I'm going to a nut house?
Because Dr. Cole thinks you're nuts.
But I told him everything you said.
He doesn't believe you. He's smart. And he told them that you need treatment. You know what treatment is? They lock you in a room all alone with no pictures or books. They strap you to a bed. They won't even let you go to the bathroom. Then, every day, they stick needles in you.
No. And if you think I'm going to hang around there, you really are nuts.
Mary?
Mary, Mary, quite contrary. When will the nightmares end? A psychological suspense thriller of a family desperately trying to start again after the death of their oldest daughter, Jennifer. A new home in a new location and a promising new job seem like the perfect way to forget. Philip, Dennis Weaver, and Laura, Valerie Harper, moved their two children to a country home in Northern California. The only hitch was Laura's mother, Bernice, Ruth Gordon, was moving in with them. Neither Philip nor the kids cared very much for the aging woman. Was it the country seclusion that started Mary's nightmares again, or was she still grieving over the death of Jennifer? Whatever the reason, something frightening, something deadly, had a hold on her and was not letting her go until Jennifer's death was avenged. Mary thinks there's something alive under her bed. Mary is right. That is the back of the box of the video I've got, Don't Go to Sleep, which I think must be quite rare because I've never seen another copy. I bought it from a website many moons ago. It's the American release on something called Unicorn Video, but it said it was copywritten to Lorimar Telepictures Corporation. So whether or not it was an official release, I don't know, but that was the box. It was a film that has a special resonance with me, and I've spoken about this before on the podcast because I watched it with my family when it aired in the UK, and I believe it came out in the States or first aired in December of 1992, so it must have been around that time or early 83 that I would have seen it. And for me, and I've spoken many times before, I'd always wanted to see kind of the horror movies slash movies coming out in the early 80s, but I was too young to see them, certainly at the cinema. And of course, they weren't airing on TV, so I'd only see trailers, read the novelizations, that type of thing. So Don't Go to Sleep, to me, was kind of the was certainly a world away from the old aging Hammer horrors and the black and white films that were being shown on the BBC UK channels at that time. And I remember us being spellbound. And when I caught up with the film many years later, of course, it has an air. Oops, who's that?
That was my cat. That was my cat. Sorry.
That's all right. No, it's always, it's always good to have a pussy on the podcast, as you know. But we caught up. No, I didn't mean it that way. Sorry. No, I shall clarify. But when we caught up with the film. I caught up with the film many years later. It has that kind of air of camp around it, but of course then that's a pleasure, certainly not a detraction from the film. But it also, given the kind of general cheesiness of the film, it actually has a kind of quite a kind of rawness that you don't necessarily see. And I think, like Amanda was talking about earlier, that TV movies tend to go places that other films, even theatrical films, tended not to. And in this, it's kind of, I wouldn't say it's exactly a realistic portrayal of a family breaking down after the deaths of various children and family members. But certainly there's one sequence where the couple are arguing after the death of one of the children, which goes on for about 5 minutes and is particularly kind of raw. Also, of course, the thing that stood out for me at the time was the pizza cutter scene, which is where the one scene where the film really goes full on slasher, or certainly kind of it's certainly borrowing from the slasher movie, is the kind of indelible scene of the pizza cutter being rolled up the staircase, up the banister of the staircase, slowly as Valerie Harper is searching for her husband who's been drowned in the bathtub. And then the very brief chase sequence where she's chased by the person holding the pizza cutter. But that was full on slasher movie, whereas the rest of the film is kind of more of a ghost story, I kind of guess. But certainly it's a one by one murder pick, and in so much that the cast are bumped off one by one. So I still think, and especially the film has an amazing payoff, which is still quite, I think is still quite chilling. And there's passages of the film that are, I believe, still raise goosebumps. So although I, as Amanda cautioned before about certain films about going in not necessarily expecting, or not like fantasies not being a full-on slasher movie, Don't Go to Sleep certainly is not a full-on slasher movie, and if you go in expecting one, you'll be disappointed. But you go in with an open mind, and if you have a love for TV slasher movies or TV horror movies from the 1970s and 1980s, there's a lot to enjoy there, and certainly there are elements of what was in vogue at the time at the cinemas, a slasher movie. And of course, it's one of the Don't movies, which was probably riffing off things like Don't Answer the Phone and Don't Go in the House and all those films from a few years before that. So, but as our guest of honour, Amanda, what are your thoughts on Don't Go to Sleep?
Well, something that you said was interesting, that we were kind of talking about how TV movies do things differently. And, you know, Oliver Robbins, I think, is the actor's name who played the little boy who was Kevin. You know, he did Poltergeist in this movie pretty much back to back. And I'll read a quote later from somebody in the newspaper who compared the two. But, you know, theatrical films are more about the spectacle, whereas TV movies are more about the personal. And so... where Poltergeist is deals with, I mean, there's really no death in the family, but like it's dealing with the spectacle of what's happening in the house. Whereas this film is dealing with actual grief in ways that so many films don't. And when I was making up my Miskatonic presentation, I started to think about all these different movies that are haunted house stories or possession movies or ghost stories. And there's two reasons why they work really well on television. And that is because you're watching the invasion of the domestic space within your own domestic space, which I think adds a level of anxiety that you don't get in the theater. But also, like, if you look at a movie like The Changeling with George C. Scott, which is this amazing film, it didn't do well in the theater, but it did really well on a home video. It has a cult following now because I think it's a really intimate look at loss. And so a lot of these haunted house movies and ghost stories opt to look at what happens to the family or the person after somebody is gone. And Don't Go to Sleep does it probably better than any horror film I can think of offhand in terms of, like you said, that really raw scene between Valerie Harper and Dennis Weaver. And there's a realism there that you don't get in a lot of other films. And that's what stands out to me most about Don't Go to Sleep. Also, I mean, it's a great film. It really stands up. But, like, there's so many things about it that are so well done. Like, just the music that you played, it's so childlike and whimsical. And it really plays on this idea of what has manifested Jennifer into the house. Is it real? Is it manifested from the guilt? Because everybody's sort of trading... who did what to whom to have Jennifer's death occur. And they're all not only carrying guilt for their own actions, but they're also passing the blame to each other. And I think that that's probably a really realistic viewpoint of when you lose somebody like a child. It's just so well done. I think the acting is really good. I think Valerie Harper is the queen of everything, first of all. So just having her in it, and she's amazing, and she really carries the film in so many different ways. It's just... there's so much I want to say, but of course I can't think of what to say, except that I think it's excellent. I think it really captures the fear and terror that you would get in a really solid ghost story. But at the same time, it's also telling a very human story. But there's a point, like when they're like, people are dropping like flies and you're like, Jesus Christ, you know, where also Dennis Weaver has a bar in his bathtub.
That's amazing. I was going to have a bath later and a martini. So yeah, I was going to have a picture of a martini in the bath later after the podcast.
That's my dream. And so, like, when he dies, it's like at least he died happy because he's drinking the martini and he makes this face like, oh,
yeah,
this is my great love. And then it's over. And you're like, that's how I want to go, in the bathtub with the martini. So I think the death scenes are really good. I think the scene with the little boy is really good. It's really suspenseful and drawn out. You kind of know what's going to happen, but it's filmed in such a way that it really makes it suspenseful. I don't know about the iguana thing. I mean, it's good, but, like, you know, I don't know that that's like the best murder I've ever seen. But it's just got these really interesting elements in it that are, like, you're right, it's kind of a hodgepodge of all these different ideas and thoughts and, like, hot selling points for theatrical films, all kind of boiled into this weird little family drama that becomes a metaphor for something bigger than what you think it is, which is what makes it so good and what helps it transcend its genre. And that's what I'm going to say.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Amanda. We'll come back to you shortly. But Joseph, what's your thoughts on Don't Go to Sleep? Is this a film you've seen? I presume you've seen it before.
Yes, I saw it a long time ago. And for some reason, I always thought Dennis Weaver was severely miscast. But watching it last night, I was... kind of struck by how great he was in the film. I don't know why I thought he was bad before, but anyway, I think he's terrific in the film, actually. And I think this film is probably pound for pound one of the best, if not the best, made for TV horror films. You know, like Amanda said, the one thing that's really stuck out to me, aside from this being a great commercial for birth control, because the kids really just kind of got on my nerves. No, but one thing that really stuck out for me was the ghost element could almost be seen as maybe not even really there. It's maybe we're just seeing a physical manifestation of grief and trauma over past events. You could take the ghost stuff out and it still plays pretty much the same. I mean, the dad drank one too many, the grandmother pushed him into it, the mother, is blaming, everyone else or whatever, and the kids are the practical jokers who tied the, to get into this, a little bit of spoiler here, tied the little girl's shoes together. I mean, everyone's at blame, everyone's throwing blame, everyone's dealing with this in some kind of strange, fascinating way. But no, I mean, it's just such a very layered film. It's quite scary in a lot of places. Like you said, the pizza cutter scene is just phenomenal. The acting, like I said before, I don't know why I had a problem with it before, but watching it last night, I was struck by how good everyone was. Even the kids who kind of got on my nerves, I thought the kids were really well played. If I have one little fault with the movie, and this is just like a minor nitpick, is the very final shot is a reaction to an action, and I thought they should have froze on the action. Instead, they cut away from that, and this is more spoilers, is basically just kind of the vision of someone at the foot of someone's bed. I thought it would have played better if they froze on that instead of going into sort of a cheap looking kind of Hitchcock dolly zoom into one character's face. I thought they should have just stopped at the foot of the bed and it would have just gave it more of a powerful punch. But that's like my only little nitpick, which is to an otherwise, a great little film.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you, Joseph. Eric, how about you? What are your thoughts?
Yeah. When it comes to TV movies for me, I'm one of the guilty ones who, Amanda was saying, I sometimes use the term, it felt a bit like a TV movie, as a negative, and I have been guilty of saying that in the past. For me, when it comes to horror movies on TV, they can be quite hit and miss. I think the format's best served by the tawdry true life stories. They're the ones I really love, and when it comes to made for TV. So there was a couple you covered recently, Amanda, the two Tori Spelling movies, Death of a Cheerleader and Co-Ed Call Girl. Now, they're ones that I love, and I could rewatch those over and over again. Home for the Holidays is one that I think I'm probably the least enthusiastic about amongst us. I think it's okay, but I wasn't that mad about it. This one, however, as Joseph was saying, it's probably one of the best made-for-TV horror movies I've seen. And I wouldn't have the encyclopedic knowledge that you'd have, Amanda, but for me, this is in the upper echelons. At the start of it, it's quite slow, and I was wondering. I had seen it before about 10 years ago, but I didn't really remember that much about it. So watching it again, I felt the start of it was quite slow, and it felt a bit episodic. And there was some kind of what I felt were tame haunted house cliches were sort of stitched together. The croaky voice, calling out Mary, the mysterious happenings, the burning bed, which even though the burning bed should be a pulse racing moment, it felt a bit uneventful to me. So early in the film, I was wondering if I was going to be the sole voice of dissent on this movie, because I imagine we're all pretty enthusiastic about it. But it's in the second half things really kick off for me. As you say, it's quite a dark film. It's quite thematically, it's quite adventurous for a film that was going to be shown. I don't know what time slot it was in, but I'm imagining it was about 8 o'clock in the evening. So it's quite dark and grim in places for something that was being shown on television. The family unit is shown as being more dysfunctional as the film goes on. The possible, it's intimated that Dennis Weaver's an alcoholic because he likes his martinis. Isn't that right, Justin?
Well, I think it's more than intimated, but I haven't drunk a martini in the bath yet, although that is something I aspire to.
Just don't put the radio too near. Can you be electrocuted by a radio falling into the bath? I'm not sure you could.
I think you could, but I don't think in British bathrooms you don't have sockets.
Sockets, yeah, there's no sockets.
That was actually dispelled on MythBusters, Eric. You cannot. You could probably get a shock, but I don't think it'll kill you.
Yeah, it's more when you put the sort of the electric bar heaters into the bath. That's when it becomes a nuisance.
I thought that's really downplaying it. This kind of okay.
You
say, "Oh, what a nuisance! I'm dead."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Yeah. I think the acting in it is excellent, and I would particularly single out. I've lost the actress's name here now in my notes, but the actress who plays young Mary. I think like the more and more the film goes on, the more and more sinister she gets. I thought she was excellent in it. Yes. Yeah. And I like the ambiguity, as Joseph was saying there, the ambiguity about whether there actually is a ghostly Jennifer that's haunting Mary, or if it's all in her head, if sort of guilt and, you know, grief has turned it into a psychopathic killer, basically. The pizza cutter scene is excellent. Really, really well done. That's the scene that is straight out of a theatrical slasher movie for me. And I also like the scene where Kevin is trying to get his frisbee off the roof. Now, in the 1970s and 80s, there was a series of public information films that used to go around on Irish and UK television. I don't know if you got similar ones in the US, but there's a famous one of a guy trying to get a boy trying to get his frisbee off of an electrical pylon thing. Do you remember that one, Justin?
I do.
This is what it reminded me of very much. And I love the scene where poor Kevin, played by Oliver Robbins, falls off the roof, and then it cuts straight to Valerie Harper dropping a watermelon on the floor. I thought that was it's kind of fun.
She didn't carry the watermelon, did she?
She didn't. No, she was no baby. She certainly was no baby.
Sorry, Eric. I know you'll get this one. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're talking about the frisbee scene. I was thinking about, oh man, I've been waiting 9 years to get my frisbee back. Oh, The Simpsons. Oh.
Yes.
Sorry.
It also seems that there's a lot of technical prowess going on in this film that I didn't see in something like Home from the Holidays. You know, there's lots of camera movement, particularly in that towards the end where we see Mary in the asylum. There's lots of sort of overhead shots, and the camera is panning around her, and it felt
excellent cinematography. I forgot to mention that. Yeah, it is.
When she rolls under the bed the first time.
Yeah,
the way the camera flows up, it's so beautiful, and it's got that children's music playing, and it's so creepy.
Yeah, the one thing I'd love about to see more of with these TV movies is proper restoration, because any ones I watch, they tend to be on YouTube or they tend to be bootlegs, and they look kind of washed out. You know, I'm thinking back particularly to Home for the Holidays, which is quite a dark looking movie from what I remember. So it would be nice if you know, some of these could be polished up a bit. Be easier on the eye, maybe. But yeah, I thought the film was excellent, and it's Robert Ignico is the actress who plays Mary. I thought she was brilliant. Certainly in the final 30 minutes, I thought she really shined. So yeah, it was an essential watch for anyone that's, you know, you don't have to be into made for TV horror. I think if you're just into horror, then this is one for you. Again, I'm not sure how closely it adheres to the slasher format. It's more of a evil child movie to me, but thumbs up.
Excellent. Yay. Well, thank you, Eric. What about you, Nathan?
I mean, I love the movie. I've always loved Don't Go to Sleep. I can't think of anything, I guess, that you guys haven't already mentioned that, and I don't want to echo, you know, everything you guys have said, because, I mean, obviously stuff like, you know, the pizza cutter scene is great. I especially love the fact that, you know, she's cutting the pizza normally, and even before, like, you know, the pizza cutter, you know, we see it going up the stair rail and all that, you see, like, the pizza cutter on the pizza just slicing it, you know, with very, you know, aggressive...
That's what I'm like.
If
I'm really hungry, that's what my pizza cutting skills
but
are.
Who buys a pizza that's not cut? Like from a pizza place.
Well, pizza, I will say,
it looks like there's about 14 tons of spinach on top of the half of the pizza.
There is, yeah.
You buy the pizza, you cut it. We pass the savings on to you. Sorry.
Some pizza places don't cut it very well. You have to go back over it.
Yeah. I'm not buying it. This movie sucks.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That scene took me out of the movie.
I hate this movie. Yeah. This movie's terrible.
Can I just say, I remember ages ago, Justin mentioning this film on the podcast and talking about that scene where the pizza cutter goes up the stairs. And I had visions in my head of just a pizza cutter on its own just going up the stairs. And I'm thinking, what the hell?
Well, if I could get back to my opinion about the film.
Please. Oh, sorry. Is he still your favorite, kidding. Amanda, after that outburst? Or
I have to think about it.
Oh, gasp.
Gasp. Okay, so Nathan, you carry on.
Carry on? Okay. I watched this with Grant several years ago, and he actually called me the next day, and he's like, I'm still thinking about that movie. So that's pretty high praise, I'd say.
Hmm. Yeah.
If it stuck with him, it was the final shot. The final shot.
I was there when we watched him. Yeah.
Yeah.
He covered his eyes the whole time.
He kept thinking something was going to jump out on the screen.
Yeah.
It's not really a cover your eyes type of film, I wouldn't think.
No, but
it is for him. As good as it is. Yeah.
It is for him. He covers his eyes at everything.
But yeah, I mean, the final shot like really got him. He's like, I kept picturing it when I was laying in bed that night.
It's quite difficult. It's quite difficult to make pigtails or whatever kind of side buns kind of scary.
It was scary on its own.
But they managed it.
They did.
But no, I mean, it's a fantastic movie. I mean, it's a, you know, two thumbs up.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you, Nathan. Well, I know we're a little bit time constrained today, and we're already kind of running at a wonderful, almost an hour and 40 minutes, so which is going to be another epic, which is fantastic. But let's just move on some background. And Amanda, I think as the queen of the TV movie, do you want to give us some background?
Yeah, I'll just tell you what it ran against. It aired on December 10th, 1982 on ABC. It ran against Dallas and Falcon Crest on CBS. And on NBC, it ran against Knight Rider and Remington Steele, which are two big heavy hitter, four big heavy hitter shows. It didn't do so well in the ratings. I couldn't find the exact ratings for the week, but I was able to find the ratings it placed in the 1982-83 season in the list of TV movies and specials that aired that season. So it came in number 201 out of 231 TV movies and specials that aired. So it didn't do very well. Yeah, its exact rating was a 10.9/17. So what that means is 10.9 million households were watching it, which represents 17% of the households in America that had televisions, which isn't horrible, but not big numbers. It had a wide variety of criticism. Some critics thought it really dealt well with like the family dissension and dealing with grief and trauma. Other people called it just straight up garbage. Some of that came to people associating it with Aaron Spelling, who produced it, which I think is ridiculous and a travesty in itself. There were people who wrote into newspapers. I'll just read you two readers' opinions. Someone said, "Thank you, ABC, for Don't Go to Sleep. The film accomplished what Steven Spielberg set out to do with Poltergeist. Valerie Harper and Dennis Weaver made you care about a family being destroyed by horror." Alternately, somebody else wrote into a different newspaper saying the ABC movie Don't Go to Sleep was sick and disgusting. Dennis Weaver and Valerie Harper wasted their wonderful talents. This came out in a year that Valerie Harper made three TV movies. This is, of course, her most famous, but she did a really excellent film called Invasion of Privacy, which was sort of marketed as a thriller. You can watch the promo for it on YouTube, but is actually a story about a woman who gets raped. She goes to this small town to get over her divorce and kind of get back her life back in order. And she is raped by a local. And, of course, everybody loves the local and hates her. And the fact that she had sex just prior to the rape comes a bone of contention with the courts. And it's a really interesting film. She also did a pilot movie called Feral for the People, which, ironically enough, has her playing a DA handling a rape case. So rape was the name of the game for her in this season, with the exception of this film. It was directed by Richard Lang, who did Night Cries, which is a really interesting supernatural movie from the late 70s with Susan St. James. He also did the pilot for Shooting Stars with Parker Stevenson and Billy Dee Williams. And he directed Velvet, which was another pilot movie, which was like a Charlie's Angels ripoff with Sherry Belafonte and the mom from Dawson's Creek, which was written by Ned Wynn, who wrote this movie. So Ned Wynn is Keenan Wynn's son, and you probably would recognize Keenan Wynn if you Googled him. He was a famous character actor, and he wrote a biography about growing up in Hollywood with a famous father. And so his mother was married to Keenan Wynn and got divorced and then married another famous actor named Van Johnson the day after her divorce was legal. But they had all three been friends for a while before the divorce. And he writes about this in his book. And I only bring this up because he talks about a car accident that Keenan Wynn Evie Nguyen and Van Johnson were in with two other people. So I just want to read you this excerpt because I think it's interesting. In 1943, the three were in a car with two friends driving to a studio preview of the Hepburn Tracy film Keeper of the Flame when they were hit by a car which jumped a red light. Van Johnson, who was driving, was seriously hurt, and Evie suffered a back injury. The others were only shaken. Johnson, who nearly died, spent his long recovery period at the Nguyen's home. In 1945, Keenan Nguyen and Evie Nguyen separated, with Keenan Nguyen commenting, "Our marriage had followed the inevitable sad courses of marriages in decline. We had gone from coolness to bickering and then to open disputes. We had nothing in common, no shared interests except in our son." And so I think this is really interesting because we're looking at like the breakup of a family. Well, first of all, we're looking at five people in a car accident where something traumatic happened. And then we're talking about how afterwards things fell apart for the family. And I don't know if that's an inspiration for Ned Nguyen later, but I thought that that was really striking to me, and so I wanted to mention it. Also, Valerie Harper and Dennis Weaver appeared in another TV movie together called The Day the Loving Stopped, which I haven't seen, but I'm sure it's incredible because they are incredible. And Dennis Weaver is a god. I'm done.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, they also both were like in similar car stalking films, right? So Dennis Weaver was in Duel, and then Valerie Harper years later made a Duel sort of ripoff called Night Terror, where she is being stalked by somebody.
Oh, it's really good.
Oh, yeah, Night Terror is fantastic. I actually prefer that over Duel.
Yeah, in some ways I do too. In some ways I do too. It's really creepy. Really,
Yes.
Plus, I felt like she was, you know, for the most part, Valerie characters, Valerie Harper's character. I really liked her character in, Night Terror. I thought, you know, she played it very, very well.
We watched that one at Grant's. Remember, Nathan?
Yeah, we did.
That was really good.
There's a transformation there. I mean, Dennis Weaver sort of like has to get some cojones by the end. There's real fear though in Duel that's super palpable that has not really been duplicated in a lot of ways. But Valerie Harper does have almost like a final girl transformation because she starts off really like helpless, and then by the end of the film she's got it. You know what I mean? And so it's maybe more in line with, like, it might be more appealing to slasher people because I think of the final girl imagery in it. Although I don't remember getting all this strength at the end, but she's definitely, like, really fighting in that film for survival. It's really interesting.
Hmm. Well, interestingly, Duel was one of the films that got a cinema release, I believe, in the UK. So, thank you, Amanda. Who else would like to go as some background? Nathan, do you want to fill us in? What have you been reading on IMDb today?
Ooh.
No.
Fuck you. Don't mind your own business.
I was only doing that to get reaction.
I've never said that to anybody. Well,
what, the F word?
Except that woman in the video.
What video?
When you were picking your rhubarb.
Well, I see, right. Rhubarb. Okay. She just happened to come along and try to tell me I couldn't. And that rhubarb's part of the street. It's neighborhood rhubarb, so I can pick it if I want to.
It's alley.
The lawnmower got taken by a fucking pig.
Yeah. So, Nathan.
My favorite part, though, is what did she say? Don't call me sweetie honey bun or something like that.
Yeah. So
I don't know how I got that nickname. I'm so nice.
Well, I think we can all listen back. I think we know that sometimes it's you sometimes turn.
You do.
Mm. I have like a dark side. I can't.
You do.
It.
You're like Mary and Don't Go to Sleep.
I know. I'm gonna be at the foot of y'all's beds tonight. Sorry about your luck.
Well, there's something to look forward to or be frightened of. I'm not sure, but Nathan, do you have any background for us?
No, I forgot to pull up IMDb.
Okay.
I'm very sorry. Plus, I mean, in my defense, I was on vacation all week. So, and it's only been a week since we last recorded. So I haven't, you know, I was a little pressed for time, unfortunately.
Oh, on vacation. I see. Okay. Joseph, how about you? Have you got anything for us?
The only thing I have, it's not really background, is there was a video store here in town called Marquee Movies who had the box, but someone rented the tape and never returned it because I remember seeing that. And Alan, the guy who owned Marquee Movies, was very upset because it was one of his favorites. But that's all I have.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Joseph. Eric, what about you?
Okay. Mine isn't really background either, but as Amanda said, it aired on Friday the 10th of December, 1982. If you didn't want to sit in and watch TV, then you could have gone out to see some new releases of the cinema, such as The Toy, 48 Hours, or Airplane 2, the sequel, which also had Oliver Robbins in it. And also, if you didn't want to go to the cinema or watch TV, you could have gone out to see Toya in concert at Lancaster University that very night.
Well, there you go, Justin. Horror to another. Yes.
So no, but
don't go to see Toya.
Don't go to see Toya. Yeah, I'd pay to see that.
I wouldn't. Anyway, it was as Amanda was saying, directed by Richard Lang. He also went on to work on Beverly Hills 90210. He directed maybe 8 or 9 episodes, including you'll probably remember this one, Amanda and Nathan as well. The awful Christmas episode where there's a pair of guardian angels looking down. On,
Oh, I love it.
Oh no, that makes me cringe, that episode. Oh my god.
Well, I mean, I love it for cheesy value.
Yeah. He also directed the episode where Donna Martin gets drunk at the prom, but not famously, he didn't do the episode where Donna Martin graduates. So he did the setup. Cool. He did the setup.
That's the episode where Brenda loses her virginity, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Talking
her and Dylan in the hotel room.
Oh, yeah. So good.
And I don't want to go too far off, I guess, subject here, but since we are talking about 90210 now, I was wondering, is there an episode, because I've been watching it on Hulu, and I've been watching it in order, but I feel like I've missed an episode, and they don't have it on Hulu, but is there an episode where Scott from season 1 kills himself in season 2?
He doesn't kill himself. No.
It's an accident, right? Okay.
Yeah, it is. It's season 2, yeah.
Hulu has skipped that episode, and it's so weird.
Oh, that's one of the best episodes.
That's interesting. The part I remember most about that episode, for some reason, is that I think it's this episode. They're all dancing right there at the party. All these like super cool kids somehow end up at Scott's house, and Shannon Doherty does this thing where in her dance move, where she gets on one knee. Do you remember this? And then she gets up, and it's just the weirdest dance move ever. But I love it.
They're all at the party because David Silver has all emotionally blackmailed them into going.
The coolest kids.
Speaking of 90210, Justin has put something very mean up on his review of Don't Go to Sleep. Have you seen it?
No, I read it.
He concludes his review with, "Who thought Aaron Spelling would have been one of the driving forces behind this sublime TV terror flick? Although he later further proved his horror mettle when he unleashed Tori onto the unsuspecting world."
Oh, I remember that. Yes, you know what? So let's real quick say Aaron Spelling executive produced over 140 TV movies in his lifetime, including Home for the Holidays and Satan's School for Girls, and The House That Wouldn't Die. He really knew his stuff.
Yeah,
and
Justin.
He made really good horror movies. He's not known for that, but that is something that he did, and he did better than almost any other producer going in his time. So,
there you go. Yeah. Amanda, it's turned into Inga.
Oh, yeah.
I have Inga.
But also, Amanda, Justin spells Tori wrong on his page. It's T-O-R-R-I, so it's Tori he's called her.
Oh, well.
Yeah, Justin.
I wrote that a long time ago.
Yeah.
10 co-ed call girls for you now.
Yeah.
Well, just actually, be glad you didn't get a death of a cheerleader.
Yeah.
That's right.
You're so perfect and funny and confident.
You're so pretty and confident. I've admired you, Stacey. I've always admired you.
Well, talking of Beverly Hills 90210, which I did watch and I did very much enjoy at the time. I'm not sure so much whether I would now. But have you seen the latest episode of RuPaul's Drag Race?
No.
Because
90210 Ho.
Jenny Garth and Tori Spelling are guest judges, and they recreate, is it Donna's drunken prom?
Oh, cool.
Because it's got to be Donna's drunken prom. Mm.
And it's on the latest episodes on Netflix, if you get that, Eric.
I do get Netflix, yes.
Yes, so that's
have a look.
Yeah, have a look. So, I may look at my relationship of Aaron Spelling and Tori Spelling. I think at least she grew in my estimation when she took the piss out of herself in Scream 2.
Yeah, she was very funny in that, I thought.
Yeah,
She's very self-aware. Like, if you read interviews with her from the 90s, she kind of was fully, even before the internet, she was fully aware of all the shit people were saying about her and that she was sort of an in-joke in a lot of ways, and she played up on that. In a number of ways, and I really love her. Plus, she's in a movie called Coed Call Girl.
Yeah, and in that film, it's like she's this coed who becomes a call girl.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Pauline Kael.
She deals with like a really mean piano player too.
He's not that mean, and he's really cute. He's really cute.
He's very cute, but I mean, it was like stand there.
Take off your clothes.
Play this song.
And she puts on there's one scene where she puts on the most appalling amount of lipstick ever.
In my review, I think I wrote, there's a photo in the book. We use a photo for a promo still. And I think I wrote Tori Spelling and her lip liner star in Co-Ed Call Girl. It's very bronze. It's very 90s. And her hair is so stiff that you felt like if she fell out of a building and landed on her head, she would survive.
Well, that's the 80s and 90s for you. So,
yes.
Anyway, the bottom line is hooray for Erin Spelling.
Okay.
Yes.
Has anyone else got anything, any other background they would like to? I've just got a couple of little bits.
No, go ahead with your little bits.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Nathan. I was going to say one Valerie Harper slasher movie, TV slasher we haven't spoken about is The People Across the Lake.
Oh, yeah.
From 1988, which is kind of like, as I reviewed it on the site, and that's a kind of a fun movie that came out on VHS in the UK, so that's well worth a look at. Just to mention what the actors and actresses went on to do, what they're doing at the moment, is Robin, who played Mary, was in a film called No Visitors in 2015, played a burglar, so I don't know, she hadn't done anything for years. But Oliver Robbins, again, Kevin, who was obviously famously in Poltergeist 1 and 2 and Airplane 2, he has got a film out this year, his screenwriter, called The Devil's Whisper, which looks like a genre kind of demon-type movie. So he's still doing stuff. Obviously, neither Valerie Harper or Dennis Weaver are still with us, or Ruth Gordon, unsurprisingly.
Valerie Harper's with us.
Sorry? Who is?
Did you say Valerie Harper wasn't with us?
Valerie Harper's not with us, is she?
Yes, she is. Say that.
Oh my God, Justin, how could you do that?
I thought she.
Oh my
died.
God.
I thought she.
I thought I wanted to sleep with you.
Hold on. I thought she died. Which one was the one that died recently?
Mary Tyler Moore.
Oh right. Okay. They.
Valerie Harper has cancer and she's had it for a number of years, but she's like got some treatment that she's been able to live with it, and she's going to be with us for many, many more years. Okay.
That's
good to hear. Sorry, I've got Mary Tyler Moore and Valerie Harper mixed up. So, yeah, sue me.
Who's turning all rhubarby?
I know, Inga.
Right. My goodness.
So anyway, that's my that's all the background I have for Don't Go to Sleep.
But, well, and it was wrong.
So yeah. So people don't listen to this show for accuracy.
Oh, sorry.
They don't listen for accuracy. We can just say whatever we want.
Exactly.
Justin, you're always right and you're beautiful when you're doing it.
Thank you. And Bob Hoskins is alive and well and living
in
Saint-Tropez.
He is. In my heart, he is.
Yeah.
And
well,
in my
hey, you know, going off of Justin's background, I've got a ton of background. I directed Don't Go to Sleep. Yeah. I wrote it. I was only two, but I
yeah,
did.
It was filmed on the moon.
One last thing I did want to say about the film is the only thing is going back to what it said originally and what it says in your book, Amanda, about how they gave them outrageous titles. I mean, the title doesn't actually make a great deal of sense, does it? Because there's no
I was thinking about that as well. Yeah,
there's no threat in going to sleep, is there? All the threat happens before people go to sleep, apart from when the burning bed is.
Well, no, because she's sleeping. She's saying no, Mary, no, like in her sleep a bunch of times, and maybe that's meant to clue in the manifestation of it.
Mm. Very possibly, yes.
I don't know.
But should we go on from that? Have we got any feedback on the forums, the Facebook forums, Joseph, about this film?
Yes, a couple of things here. Chad Hemsley says, I remember the film being advertised on TV with the clip of the daughter crying on her burning bed. Freaked me out like you wouldn't believe, and I was terrified to go to bed for weeks, lest my bed be transformed into a hellish inferno. Mike Alishan says, a very sad film, puts me in a melancholic state. Very creepy film with a classic eerie soundtrack. The pizza cutter scene is one of the best POV slasher moments put on film. Well, TV film. Dennis Weaver was great in this. I loved him in Duel as well. David Ladd says, one of my favorite made-for-TV movies from the early 80s. A very eerie vibe hangs over this entire film that still works today. This one, along with other made-for-TV movies I like, I Desire and Dark Night of the Scarecrow, caused me many sleepless nights when I was a kid. Bob Hartshorn says, Possession and Pizza Cutters don't mix, folks. What a great little movie, eh? It's like an Ingmar Bergman family meltdown drama reimagined as a supernatural version of The Bad Seed. Domestic social realism crossed with ghostly slasher tropes don't come much better or bleaker than this. I only saw Don't for the first time a few weeks ago, so great timing, JJEN. That's Joseph, Justin, Eric, and Nathan. More creepy TV movie coverage, please. David Cook says, a few years ago I suffered from insomnia and spent most nights watching these old TV movies. A lot of it may be down to nostalgia. I used to watch these as a kid, but while some are bland, the best can be gripping. And Nathaniel Thompson says, one of the scariest made-for-TV movies ever. Saw it when I was nine and never looked at a pizza cutter the same way again, and always kept my shoelaces away from my siblings in the car after this. Mm-hmm. Eric Kent says, this one warped my impressionable young mind. The iguana scene still haunts me all these years later. Is there a legit release of this somewhere? And I think we've dispelled that notion. Jenny Hall Cameron says, poor Oliver Robbins. Always fun times with him when he has two sisters. And finally, Simon Logan.
Ooh.
That's Simon Logan says nothing because he didn't write in, the bastard.
Oh, Simon Logan.
Yes.
Well, thank you for everyone who wrote in. Yeah. We've got, we'll talk about what we're covering next on the show. I think it's Nathan's pick next time, isn't it?
It is. But before we get to that,
we are going to, yes.
I want to do in the credits. After the credits. I can't even get the name of the whole thing right.
Algonquin round credits.
I can't even get that right.
Before the credits.
I'm so saddened.
Credits.
Yes.
Credits before
Okay. Oh, go ahead, Justin.
No, you go ahead.
What are you going to say? Okay, I'll go ahead. The floor is open. I'm curious as to what you all think happened, after the credits rolled. I mean, what happened to these characters, the ones that were left standing?
Well, do you want to say, Nathan, maybe you can just say what the ending of the film is, which is obviously going to be a huge spoiler, but just to give an idea, just so we can set the scene.
Okay. All right. Well, the whole movie, you kind of think, or, they like you guys have said, they kind of play with the whole, is the daughter, is her sister really there? Is she crazy? Is she really the evil one? What's going on? So at the end, the sister is put in a mental asylum in a padded cell, and the mom is climbing into bed, the very end. And, basically the ending is, the ghost daughter rises up at the foot of the bed. And it's a very creepy shot because she's got this real evil grin on her face. And the mom screams, and then it cuts to the credits. So, with that being said, what do you guys think happened? Did the mom run out of the bedroom screaming?
I would say the mom was murdered. Mary eventually got out of the asylum, changed her name to Hillary, and had a failed presidential run.
Wow.
So we know where Joe went with it.
Well, I mean, I think that movie, I think the ending brings up a lot of questions because you could say that this proves that Jennifer as a ghostly apparition is real, but I don't know that it is because she looks different, right? At the end of the film, the look that she's giving Valerie Harper's character is, another piece of trivia that, by the way, the name of that family was the Hogan. The Hope family, which is funny because Valerie Harper ended up starring on a show called The Hogans, right? Yeah. So I wondered this time if the guilt re-manifested itself in a different way in the mom because of everything that had happened. And so what we're seeing at the end is actually a new manifestation and not the same apparition, because the expression she's making is so different, and she's not really, as far as we know anyway, because it's all point of view, she's not the conduit. She's Mary is the one committing the crimes, right? So when we see Jennifer, as she was when she died, and very beautiful and innocent, childlike. But at the end of the film, she's definitely got a more sinister look to her. So it feels like two different creations to me. So I kind of wondered if maybe it was just a re-manifestation.
So you think the mom ended up in the padded cell next?
Well, I don't think that the Jennifer was real, and so I think that she was going crazy, yes.
I like that theory.
I was thinking along the same lines. I was thinking that the mom has now gone completely mad as well. But I do like the idea that that there is something supernatural going on. So I'm going to say something about Jennifer appears, possesses the mom, and the mom goes out on a killing spree. And it's actually, it turns out that her name is what's her name and character's name in this?
Oh God, I can't even remember. Mrs. Mom? Hogan.
Yeah. Well, no. I imagine that she's actually Mrs. Voorhees, and this is actually a prequel to Friday the 13th.
Ah.
Yeah, it's the Prometheus of the Friday the 13th series.
Well, so what happened is Kevin didn't really die when he fell off the roof. He just ended up living in the backyard for 5 years. And
yes.
And then he saw his mom murdered.
Yeah, yes. Wow.
Kevin Voorhees. Kevin.
Yeah.
See, this is why this little sketch, because I think it brings up interesting opinions. Plus, you can get outlandish with it.
Yes. And we're nothing if not outlandish. Justin, what do you think happens?
Well, I think Mary spends time in the asylum, and then everyone thinks she's better. And on her 16th birthday, she's released, and she gets a job at a pizza parlor. And there's all the lights go out, and then you just see a pizza cutter rolling across the table, and then mayhem ensues.
All those people at Pizza Hut get killed.
Exactly, yes. The Pizza Hut murders.
You know what? There couldn't have been somebody with a camera there to film that, because that would have been a great slasher movie. Mm. Pizza cutter in a pizza place after hours.
You know, that's funny that you said that, because when I was watching this last night, I kept thinking this movie reminded me of Paranormal Activity in some ways.
Yes.
Well, no, I mean, you know, in Paranormal Activity, they don't leave, with a few exceptions of Don't Go to Sleep, they don't leave that house. And it's all about the dissension of that couple, really. I mean, the movie's a metaphor for, like, you know, well, 9/11, first of all, but also for the dissension of a relationship. Much like The Strangers in Open Water, they're all the same film. Yes, they are. But Paranormal Activity, like, they never leave the house. They can't get outside of themselves to go out into the world where there's other people. And largely, Don't Go to Sleep does that as well. While this thing is happening. And so they are similar in theme to me.
Mm. That's interesting. Mm. That sounds, yeah. Much deeper than we normally go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that movie.
That's what happens when you have to write like 10,000 papers in college and you pick these movies to write about.
So, well.
Oh, but I was going to say the pizza cutter thing, what you're saying here, reminded me of Silent Night, Deadly Night. You know how he gets the job at the toy store and he has to be Santa, and then fuck. Oh, my God.
I was thinking that as well. She's fine and she's normal and she is cured for all intents and purposes, but then somebody hands her a pizza cutter and suddenly she goes,
she's not as hot as Billy, no offense.
Sorry?
She's not as hot as Billy, who's like the hottest fucking thing ever.
This is one of the things I took away from meeting you, Amanda, was like one of your catchphrases, oh my God, he's so hot.
But he is so hot.
But no, you said that about lots of TV movie actors.
I did.
Stevenson.
Oh, he's super hot. He is.
All right. Oh. Well, on that bombshell, I will say, I think we'll begin to wrap things up because I know Joseph has to get to work.
I do have another thing at the game. That real quick.
Okay. Yep.
Someone finally guessed the last one right. It was The Final Terror, and Louis Kikasola guessed it right. So I have a new movie I'm thinking of. Clue number one is she dominates that costume. Clue number two is famous character actor's character's name is Peter Esk. And clue number three is, you probably saw her somewhere else.
Oh.
Oh.
Okay,
well, good luck with that, everyone. And just like to say a massive thank you to Amanda for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Very good luck with the book. And where can people pick
She
that
will
from?
Be back. She will, sure be back will be back sooner, yes. Sooner than later, because she's destined to be on one of the listener picks, which we won't talk about now, but.
I can't wait.
Yes, yay. Excellent. So what with the book, where can you people pick it up, Amanda?
Well, you can go on Amazon. Again, it's called Are You in the House Alone? A TV Movie Compendium, 1964 to 1999. It's available through Head Press. You can get the hardcover through them if you want. It's really beautiful, the hardcover. And also, my one-stop shop is really Made for TV Mayhem. And I have a companion podcast for that, which I do with Nathan and our friend Dan Budnick. And we are going to be talking about Five Desperate Women and She's Dressed to Kill next. So if you're really into slashers, that might be a fun episode to try out. It'll probably be out at the end of May.
Excellent, excellent.
Amanda, sorry, the Amazon UK is saying it's available for Kindle also. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it is, actually. I mean, we haven't ordered it like that, but I believe it is, yes. Cool. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Amanda. We look forward to chatting again soon. But for next time, Nathan, it's your choice. So I'm sure all of us are quaking in our boots at what you're going to delve into. What, tell it to the dear listeners so they can write in and let us know what they think of it. What are we going to be listening to next time? Well, sorry, talking about next time.
Well, I had to put aside something I was going to choose because even though I love the film, it's too rare, and I want to pick something I think most listeners could actually find a little easier. So I'm going with another favorite of mine, Class Reunion Massacre, a.k.a. The Redeemer.
Excellent. So good.
That'll be interesting to see if my my thoughts have changed on that one. So,
yeah, because Justin didn't like it.
No. But really? I reviewed it a long time ago, and I still got the big box, the American big box under Class Reunion Massacre title. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to rewatching that. So we'll be discussing that next time. So if you have seen the film, you've got any thoughts on it, then get in contact with the show. I don't think we've actually played the How to Get in Contact with the Show. So let's just do that quickly, just so you can give us some feedback, because we'd love to hear from you. Here we go.
The content of this podcast was provided by Justin Kurzweil, Eric Frillfall, Nathan Johnson, and Joseph Henson. If you enjoy our program and are willing and able to provide a donation, please visit us on Patreon and become a content designated subscriber. That's patreon.com/thehysteriacontinues. For non-subscriber PayPal donations and general feedback, our address is the.hysteria.continues@gmail.com. To listen and interact, simply search for The Hysteria Continues on iTunes, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Susie versus Toya forever.
And thank you. Yes, again, contact the show. And leading on from that, we'll be playing out with, in honor of Toya, we'll be playing out with the creatures, Don't Go to Sleep Without Me.
Boom.
Well, before that, a little bit of the music from the film, and then the creatures, Don't Go to Sleep Without Me. If Tori had written a song called Don't Go to Sleep, I would have still probably played the creatures, but
yeah,
would have at least given
songs to put you to sleep.
Is there no joke of the week?
You're so not my favorite joke. No, because I had a joke of the week, but you're all being punished now. I'm not going to say it.
Oh, go on, Eric.
No, I don't have a joke of the week. I don't have a joke of the week.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Why did the house alone sleep? I don't know.
Why did the house alone sleep? I'm gonna say because it didn't have a companion house to sleep with.
Was that a haiku?
To get to the other side.
We don't know, Eric. Why?
To get to the other side.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay.
Oh, that's why the house crossed the road.
Yeah. You shouldn't put me on the spot like that. I didn't have a joke prepared, and you knew it.
What, Eric, come on. You've had a whole week to prepare one. It's not like Nathan, who's been on vacation, has obviously had no time at all to do any background.
I've been working every day. Today's my first day off since we last did the podcast.
Okay, right. Well, anyway, we shall let poor Joseph go to work. Yes, we'll play out with some wonderful music. And thank you for joining us. And I hope you enjoyed that.
Wonderful music and then a bit of The Creatures.
Don't remember, I can edit this, Eric. So goodbye to that bit. So thank you for listening, everyone. And join us next time for...
You still want to sleep with him, Amanda?
Yes.
Well, there you go. See, even my talking about Aaron Spelling and like in smacking
him
down.
I know.
It's a grudge fuck. It's okay.
Well, on that bombshell, we shall bid you a fond adieu. Yoinks. So say goodbye to good people.
Bye.
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 Bye, Mary.
I think Eric's here, because I can see his blue ring lighting up.
Oh, I like Christian people.
Are you a Christian, Eric?
I am. I want to have sex with all of them.
Thinking of me, and I mean, really, it's going to be like, oh my God, he's so hot. And then Eric's going to be like, you say everybody's hot when he's listening to it. And then everybody else is going to be like, yeah, he is really hot.
I was going to tell a Stalker Channing joke, but I thought I probably shouldn't.
Sleep the stone.